Impact, Thursday at 9 on Spike.
Hey, did you guys hear? SmackDown might be moving to Thursdays.
Impact is on a new night, Wednesday at 9 on Spike.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm set. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 341 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for SummerSlam Sunday, August 17, 2014. I am the Solid Monster. Thank you to everybody who is listening on thesolidmonster.com, Stitcher Radio, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Player.fm. We're all over the place. Lots of different ways to download or stream the podcast. And my thanks to you for doing so here this week. We have the SummerSlam rundown that we're going to get to momentarily here, SummerSlam predictions for the big pay-per-view tonight on the WWE Network. We also have a full report on the Ring of Honor Field of Honor show from Brooklyn, New York. So we have some ROH news on the show this week. And on the Field of Honor show, where I was at the show Friday night, good show, crowd, not so much. And I'll get into why, what I mean by that a little bit later on. First, though, we have some PayPal shout-outs to get to for people who have donated to the podcast. You can do so on thesolidmonster.com. There is a PayPal donation box on the right-hand side. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. And thank you to Hytham, the Equalizer, Al Nawasser, Michael Deathrow Dunn, Tori, All I Do Is Win Johansson, The Reflection of Perfection, Abraham Lara, The Wrestler, Albert Morris, Anthony Law and Order Obasi, Mean Mark Ventress, and Diabolical Daniel Knott. Thank you to everybody who donated this past week. And again, you could always do so on thesolidmonster.com. Check out the right-hand side. I would very much appreciate that. SummerSlam is tonight from the Staples Center in Los Angeles. I think this makes, 5 years in a row? Maybe six? They've been coming back to the Staples Center. They love being out there in Hollywood and having their meetings with all the important people. And I would guess there'll be some celebrities in attendance as well. Of course, they're celebrity whores. They always love it when famous people are in the crowd. So let's go through the card here from the bottom to the top. We had in a late addition to the show, we have a pre-show match set between Rob Van Dam and Cesaro. Wow, they actually found something for Cesaro to do. I figured he would just be standing there as a lumberjack on the pay-per-view. Maybe he still will be, but he will be facing off with RVD on the pre-show. I'm going with Rob Van Dam. Rob hasn't been winning too many matches himself lately. I figure they throw him a bone here, give him a win. There's nothing going on with Cesaro. I mean, it's to the point now where I just don't expect him to win when he goes out there. So I figure RVD goes over. AJ Lee and Paige for the Divas Championship. I'm starting to really dig this feud now that Paige, I think, she's been settling in very nicely into the bratty heel role. This disingenuous, you know, me and AJ are best friends, even though they're really not. I'm going to go with AJ Lee. I think she retains the title. I don't think she loses it so quickly. The feud will continue, but AJ is my pick. We have Jack Swagger and Rusev in a flag match. Now, here's the deal with the flag match. I checked WWE.com earlier in the week, maybe like Tuesday, and on the website for the stipulation for this match, they said that the winner will be the first person to capture their own flag. So in one corner, you'll have the Russian flag. In the opposing corner, you'll have the American flag. It's Vince Russo's favorite match. It's on a pole. You climb, you take down your flag, you win the match. That's traditionally how most flag matches would work. And that was what the website said. Then other reports came out from other wrestling sites that said, according to those in WWE, including people in creative, that's not what they heard. Their impression was that it was pinfall or submission to win the match. And then whoever wins, that person's national anthem would play. So it would either be the Russian national anthem or the American anthem, the U.S. national anthem. Well, I think on the website last I checked, they don't even have anything anymore as far as what the stipulation is. They took down what they originally put up. So I don't even think they know. I mean, I would hope by now they do because it's actually the day of the pay-per-view. But I don't even think they really know what the hell they're doing for this match. So whatever the stipulation is, it doesn't matter. It doesn't change the outcome. I figure Rusev is going over here. He's been unstoppable ever since he came into WWE. Still undefeated. They're grooming him for bigger things, probably grooming him for John Cena at some point, whether Cena is the champion or not. I just don't see what is gained by having Swagger win this match. And I think people are getting a little too swept up in you know, Jack Swagger mania here. Oh, wow, you know, he's getting a big push, and he may actually have a shot in this match. Maybe he does, you know. I'm not saying I would be, you know, it would be jaw-dropping to see him win this match, but I think it would be a mistake. Because when this feud is over, Jack Swagger goes back to being really nobody of any great significance on the roster. They're not going to do anything with him when this feud has run its course. It's just not going to happen. He just happened to get over because of the stick that he's carrying in his hand that has a flag attached to it that has the stars and stripes. That's the only reason he's getting the reactions that he is. And good for him. Hopefully, you know, he can ride it out a little bit longer, but you got to look at the long term here, and the long term is they're building up Rusev. Jack Swagger is never going to get beyond a certain level. He's damaged goods. So I figure Rusev wins, and not only that, but I think we might actually see old Zeb take a bump or two when the match is over. Now, I thought when they had their first match, they would do a deal where Rusev put Zeb in the Accolade and put him out of action. Well, not that Zeb sees a lot of action. Well, maybe in his private life he does. But I think that it would be a good way to get heat on Rusev. It's just a matter of whether or not Zeb can take the move. And I've said before on the show here, again, he wrestles independently. I don't know how often. I don't know that he does it every week. Maybe he stopped recently. But as early as last year, I think, I remember reading a house show report from some independent show where he was wrestling Jerry Lawler. So some people may not realize that he was or is a wrestler. For him to take a bump like the camel clutch, I'm sure Rusev can protect him. I could definitely see that happening, and it would be great heat for Rusev and Lana. And the question at that point becomes, is that a write-off for the character? I would hope not, just because I like Zeb. I like him as a character. I think he could probably even contribute in a positive way behind the scenes, like he did when he was in TNA. And they got rid of him in the midst of all that political nonsense with Jeff Jarrett when all that stuff went down and Jarrett got punished for lying about, you know, dating Kurt Angle's ex-wife. And Zeb was good friends with Jeff Jarrett, so he kind of got sucked up in that whole thing. So I don't want to see him go away, but I could see that being a write-off of the character if that's the direction they wanted to go in. We have Dolph Ziggler and The Miz for the Intercontinental title. I want Ziggler to win. Okay, I want to see Dolph Ziggler do well. I want to see him get a nice run with the Intercontinental title, but I predict that Miz will win the match. I think Miz is winning. I have no faith in this company at all. They've given me no reason to have faith in them that they would get behind Dolph Ziggler. He's the best underdog they have on the roster right now. People get into his matches. They pop for the near falls. They go crazy for it, but in the end, more often than not, he disappoints. Now, he's been on something of a winning streak of late. Actually, he may have lost a match last week, but he's been winning more matches of late than he has at any point in recent months. I think that comes to an end tonight. I hope I'm wrong, but I predict that Miz will remain the Intercontinental Champion. Chris Jericho and Bray Wyatt, going to go with Bray Wyatt. See, no reason for Jericho to win this match. He already won the first. Bray wins this one. If they have one more at the next pay-per-view, I figure Bray wins that one too, and Jericho goes away. Randy Orton and Roman Reigns. I'm going to go with Roman Reigns here. I don't know if the plan is still to put Roman Reigns against Triple H at Night of Champions. I don't know what else you do with Roman Reigns. It would make sense. You know, Triple H went to Orton and said, listen, your job is to take out Roman Reigns. You're not getting a title shot until you get rid of him, because if I give you a title match, it's just going to be ruined by Reigns. So get rid of him. So if Orton can't get rid of him, then Triple H may end up taking matters into his own hands and having that big one-on-one match where he puts over Reigns. But Reigns has to get past Orton first. I figure he does that on this pay-per-view. We have Dean Ambrose and Seth Rollins in a lumberjack match. A questionable stipulation for a big grudge match like this, but I'm sure they'll make it work. I expect these guys to go out there, hopefully get a good 20 minutes or so, or close to 20 minutes, to have a classic match. These guys can go out there and tear the house down. It's just a matter of whether or not they have the time to do it, and if this dumb lumberjack stipulation hinders them from doing it. I don't think it will, but you never know. Sometimes you put a stupid stipulation on a match, and it actually makes the match worse. You could probably just put these two guys in a straight match and have an even better match. I'm going to go with Dean Ambrose here. Ambrose has not really had a big win of late. Rollins has the briefcase. You know, he's got the backing of the Authority. I don't think this is the end of the feud. It's only the first match. A little ass backwards to have a stipulation match as the first match, but it is their first meeting. You know, they did not have the match. They did the bait and switch at Battleground, which pissed off a lot of people. And here we are now at SummerSlam, and these guys better go out there and have a great match, because if the idea was, hey, we're not going to do the match in July, like we promised at the last pay-per-view, because we're going to save it. We're going to save it so these guys can go out there and have a kick-ass match at SummerSlam. Well, then these guys have a lot of expectations, you know, riding on them. They better go out there and steal the show. And I think Ambrose wins to set up a rematch at Night of Champions, possibly with the Money in the Bank briefcase hanging in the balance. And I don't know how they get to that point where Triple H and Rollins even agree to put the briefcase on the line against Ambrose, but I think that's the end game here. I think in the end there should be, you know, a ladder match with these guys with the briefcase hanging above the ring, and I think they do that at the next show. But to get to that point, Ambrose has to get a big win. You know, Rollins doesn't lose anything. He's got the briefcase, so I think Ambrose goes over. He's my pick. Then the two real main events on this show, at least in terms of how they've been booked. Stephanie McMahon, Brie Bella. Brie Bella already has her job back. There really is no stipulation in this match. But it's probably the second most promoted match on this entire pay-per-view. I'm looking forward to it just to see, you know, what they've got up their sleeve here. I expect this to be less of a match and more of an angle. I have Stephanie McMahon as my pick. I don't think this is the end of the storyline. It should be. They should just, you know, I think the time has come to have the big climax and then move on, but I could see them dragging this out one more show and maybe having another match. Question is, how does it go down? How does Stephanie win? If Nikki is out there with Brie, and I suspect she would be, or she'll be around, she'll come out at some point, I think Nikki factors into the decision, but not doing a traditional heel turn like, oh my god, Nikki just turned on Brie. I think if she costs her sister the match, it's because there's pressure being put on her by Stephanie. I think she reluctantly costs her sister the match. Because I don't think they want to split the Bella Twins up. You know, you have Total Divas, and I just think they like the idea of them being together. And I think it would pose problems if Nikki just flat out, you know, beat the hell out of her sister, cost her a big match, and now all of a sudden we have a Nikki versus Brie feud. I got to be honest with you, I have no interest in seeing a Nikki versus Brie feud. And I don't think a lot of you guys really want to see that either. Okay? Stephanie, look, we haven't seen Stephanie in a match in what, 11 years almost? It was probably October 2003, I think, when she had that match with Vince. So, and Stephanie's not a wrestler, but at least with Stephanie, you're getting a great performance. Okay, she's been the MVP of this company in terms of promos this year. I mean, she's awesome. Stephanie is just fantastic. She plays her character perfectly, very entertaining as the evil bitch heel. So at least with Stephanie, you're being entertained on some level. She's really, really good at that. All due respect to Nikki Bella, she's very attractive, she's certainly nice to look at. I don't look, and she's improved. Both Bellas have improved from where they used to be in terms of their in-ring stuff. But there isn't anything I look at Nikki Bella and say, when it comes to WWE, wrestling, in-ring, promos, all that stuff, that she's really all that good at. She's a pretty face. And big boobs. And that's about it. At least if Stephanie says something to her where she feels, I have no choice but to cost my sister the match. I'm so sorry. I don't want to do this. And she cost Nick, you know, Brie the match. Yeah, maybe they're on bad terms for a few weeks, but in the end, they'll make up. So that's kind of how I see it going down. I did float an idea on the podcast several weeks ago, a month ago maybe earlier than that, because this feud's been going on for a while. You know, when Stephanie got slapped the first time and Brie quit, that was Payback, which I think was June 1st. So this has been going on for a while now. But at some point, I floated the idea, and I know that there's very little chance of this happening. But Stephanie needs, like, a bodyguard. She needs some muscle. And I think Karma, it would be so perfect to bring Karma back. I don't know if Karma has any interest in coming back to wrestling, if she's still dealing with her own issues. You know, I don't know what's going on with her. And she actually doesn't look, the last photo I saw of her, I think she lost some weight. She had herself all dolled up with makeup. She didn't look like the awesome Kong monster that we all remember her being in TNA and when she first came into WWE. But in terms of storyline continuity, which I know is not a priority in this company, it would make sense because the last time we saw Karma, which was 3 years ago at this point, 3.5 years ago, she was being bullied by the Bella Twins, who were heels at the time. So not only do you have that aspect of it where, holy shit, this makes sense, but if she looks anything like she used to look, even if she's a little bit smaller, she's still a monster of a woman. And Stephanie brings her in to kind of do the heavy lifting for her. So I think that's a great idea. Probably not a chance of it happening, but would love to see it. In my fantasy booking scenario, Karma would make a comeback here and would help Stephanie win and would be aligned with Stephanie for the next month or two at least of this feud as it continues. But Stephanie's my pick. And then we have the main event. John Cena versus Brock Lesnar for the WWE World Heavyweight Championship. I would suspect, maybe not tonight, but probably on Raw tomorrow night, we get the new WWE Championship belt. The logo changeover is happening this weekend. You saw pictures, I'm sure, of Vince McMahon on top of Titan Tower hoisting up the new logo and that frickin' $9.99 flag. When they commit to something, I respect their commitment to the cause. You know, putting a $9.99 flag on top of your building is a little weird. It makes it look like they're selling the building for $9.99. But anyway, they have their new logo up there, so we're going to see it probably tonight. New titles are being made. They have the new logo on them. I would suspect that we'll get that probably, again, on Raw tomorrow night. And I really hope they just do away with this two-belt nonsense. Just debut a new championship belt with the new logo. Let that be the title. But Cena and Brock, talked about this match a lot. You guys know exactly where I'm going with this as far as who I think is going to win, who I want to win. The only outcome that makes any sense at all in this match, to me, is Brock Lesnar winning and Brock Lesnar becoming WWE champion. Having a champion who does not do house shows and is probably not going to be on most of your TVs, it's different. It's not something we're used to seeing in WWE. I'm still trying to reconcile how that might work. But the ideal scenario here is that the guy who ended the Undertaker streak at WrestleMania, who has been kept pretty strong, you know, ever since, what was the last match he, I guess the last match Brock lost probably was to Triple H at WrestleMania last year. I don't believe he's lost a match since. He had the match of the year last year in WWE against CM Punk at SummerSlam. He had the match with Big Show at the Royal Rumble, which was more of an angle, really, than a match. He had the streak match with Undertaker where he broke the streak at WrestleMania. That's a big deal. And in his first match back after breaking the streak, to lose for a second time to John Cena makes absolutely no sense to me at all. Even John Cena winning and then immediately having Seth Rollins cash in and become the champion, to me, is still a big mistake. I would have done the cash in, if anything. I would have at least entertained the idea of a cash in on the last pay-per-view. And then, you know, that would set up a Cena-Brock match that's not for the title, which would work if you don't want to have that issue of not having your champion missing. Then that would have worked. I kind of went out on a limb last month and made that prediction. But now, you know, even if Rollins loses, you know, and we've seen that on occasion where the Money in the Bank winner maybe would lose, but then come out at the end and win. It could happen. I wouldn't put it past them that it could happen. We had a cash in a year ago. Randy Orton cashed in and won the championship from Daniel Bryan. I don't want to see it. I don't want to see it on the show. I want to see Brock win the belt, and I want to see Brock hold on to the belt, preferably, yeah, until WrestleMania next year if they could find a way to make that work and keep him strong for Roman Reigns or whoever and build up a big, fresh challenger for him, and that person can slay the beast. You know what? It doesn't even have to be Roman Reigns. It could be Roman Reigns. It could be Daniel Bryan. If Bryan is back in time, he wins the Rumble, goes on to WrestleMania, we have a fresh match with Bryan and Brock. I think they can go out there and have a great match. Whatever they do, the key is to keep Brock strong. He's under contract, supposedly. He's under contract until WrestleMania next year. He should not lose before then. And that means he wins the title. If Cena wins and Rollins cashes in, which you could do on any show, by the way, it doesn't have to be at SummerSlam, and at the expense of Brock Lesnar. And then the question becomes, what do you do with Brock? Because, you know, he's going to be at Night of Champions, which I assume that means if Brock wins at SummerSlam, we get the rematch, you know, Cena-Brock 3 from this generation. I'm not counting their Backlash match from 2003. and you could do the third, you know, the third match between them at the next pay-per-view. I assume Cena gets his rematch if Cena loses the title, right? That's their rule. The champion gets an automatic rematch. You know, with Rollins, though, I know a lot of people would be happy. Seth Rollins, hey, look, he's the WWE champion. I hope when he cashes in successfully, whenever that may be. I don't think this is the right time to do it. I just feel like there has to be a decisive winner, and whoever wins, wins. And Cena winning does not make it any better just because Seth Rollins came out and cashed in. Cena winning, to me, is brainless. It's just not the time for him to win again and beat Brock again. So Brock wins. Why not do a story where he's trying to hit that F5? You know, Heyman's been talking about it in his promos. You know, he goes around, I've got a spoiler for SummerSlam. Brock Lesnar wins in the center of the ring with an F5. I think that's how it ends up happening. Maybe not with one F5, but I think they could craft a nice little story for the match where Brock is trying to get Cena up for the F5, and Cena can escape, he can wiggle his way out of it. But in the end, when Brock hits that move, he pins Cena. You know, but then again, it took three of them to beat The Undertaker at WrestleMania. So maybe it takes two F5s to beat John Cena instead of one. But you don't need, you know, interference and cash-ins and a bunch of nonsense. They've built this thing up great. I've loved the build-up to this match. They haven't touched once. They've built it up like a fight. That's exactly how Brock Lesnar matches should be built up, because Brock is a fighter. Legit. The guy is a fighter. He looks like a fighter. He used to be a UFC heavyweight champion. The guy is no joke. He's no fluke. He's not your average, you know, wrestler. He's not your average sports entertainer. He's there to kick ass and fuck you up. That's exactly what he said in that special after Raw Monday night. So I've loved the build-up to this match. Now they have to go out there and deliver, and I think they can. Brock, again, he was in there with a guy like Punk. Punk is obviously a great wrestler. So they had the match of the year last year. I thought that Brock and Cena was probably the match of the year in 2012. If not number one, definitely number two. I can't remember what number two would have been. But they had such a unique match at Extreme Rules. It may not have even been the best wrestling match of the year. In fact, I know it wasn't. But I thought it was so great because it was so different than anything we had ever seen before. So I'm very anxious to see what they got planned for tonight. I don't know that we're going to get blood again unless it's hard way. So how are they going to top that first match? The first match was very simple. First 30 seconds, Brock opened him up, and then he kicked his ass for the next 15. Very curious to see what they've got up their sleeve to top that match tonight. But in the end, Brock Lesnar should win. I do believe he will. And that's your SummerSlam card for 2014. I'm excited for the top two matches, which are Cena Lesnar, Stephanie Brie, for very different reasons. And I think Ambrose and Rollins could go out there and steal the show. Everything else is just kind of there to me. I'm not really invested too much in any of those matches. But I expect it to be a good show. We have Alberto Del Rio news to get to here really quickly. I mentioned last week he got shit canned for slapping one of their social media guys who may have made a racial joke to him, and he didn't take too kindly to it. He slapped the guy and got fired. So the update is this. Del Rio is going to be appearing on the Triple Mania show tonight as I record this Sunday night. He is joining the AAA promotion down in Mexico. He was on some talk shows down there this week, and he said he is not allowed to wrestle in the U.S. for 1 year. And according to PW Insider, that would mean that Del Rio was found in breach of his WWE contract. And when that happens, you cannot do any wrestling or any MMA for an entire year, nor are you paid any money that you're owed, like royalties, you know, severance, anything like that. They're not paying him. They're not giving him that money. So it's safe to say relations between Del Rio and WWE are about as amicable right now as the relations between CM Punk and WWE, which is to say that they're not good. It was also reported that the social media guy Del Rio slapped was actually this guy Cody Barbieri, not Corey Clayton, who I think is their director of social media, so I apologize for that error. He made a racial remark that got back to Del Rio. He slapped the guy, and I think what ended up happening, what happened was he approached the guy. The guy wouldn't apologize for it, so Del Rio slapped him. And he got fired as much for how hard he slapped the guy, more so than actually slapping the guy. I guess he really, you know, he must have really smacked him pretty hard That and the guy supposedly threatened that if the company didn't take action against Del Rio, he was going to file a lawsuit. And that's not something that they wanted to have happen. So I think, you know, that could become a real problem for them if this guy filed a lawsuit, you know, felt unsafe working conditions or something like that. So that put pressure on WWE to do something, to do more than just, I guess, suspend the guy. So they fired him. Other wrestlers, seemingly, according to our reports, very sympathetic to Del Rio because this Cody Barbieri is supposedly a real smug dick and has talked down to other wrestlers before. This is not the first time that he has said stuff that has rubbed people the wrong way or been downright offensive. And he's in tight with Stephanie. So it seems like he's protected. He can get away with it. At the end of the day, I said it last week, Del Rio should not have put his hands on the guy. But from the sound of it, the guy deserved to have his ass kicked. So one of these days, maybe he'll say the wrong thing. He'll mouth off to the wrong person, and he'll get more than just a bitch slap next time. Raw this past Monday night was the go-home show to SummerSlam, live from Portland, Oregon. I love the opening segment with Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman, and I like the Hulk Hogan birthday bash at the end and how they weaved Lesnar and Cena into it. Sandwiched in between those two segments, though, was not much to get excited about. Some good wrestling, but nothing to get me excited for SummerSlam. You know, I'm interested in seeing Stephanie versus Brie. I have no doubt, again, Rollins and Ambrose will have a great match. But this is a one-match show, maybe two if you're into the Stephanie Brie stuff. You take away Cena and Brock, and you have a B show. That's really what you're left with. No tag title match, as of right now. I don't even see where they add it last minute. They already have enough matches. The Usos matches have been an anchor for a lot of those recent pay-per-view shows. The stuff with them and the Wyatts, they've torn the house down. It was probably the best thing on the Battleground show last month. So without that, without the Usos defending the titles and doing their thing, I feel like it's really lacking something. Heyman Lesnar opened the show. Heyman did all the talking. Brock just stood there, which is exactly what Brock should do. Just stand there, not open his mouth, and just look mean. Paul Heyman rapped to John Cena at one point. This was some of Heyman's best work, I thought. If you really listen to what he was saying and the way he said it, he finds a way to top himself each week. You know, I could picture him sitting in the back just thinking, okay, what am I going to do this week? I got to do something different. He even said it on his DVD, which I finally got around to watching, by the way. The Paul Heyman DVD. It's fantastic. The documentary portion, I did get to watch a lot of the Blu-ray extras. Just phenomenal stuff. So if you're still on the fence, I don't know why you would be. If you're on the fence about buying the DVD or the digital version or whatever, do not hesitate. It is worth going out of your way to see. And I think it was on there that he made a comment to the effect of, I'm always thinking about new things new ways to speak and new things to weave into my promos to stay on top of my game and compete with everybody else on the roster. I want to be the best promo. And you could tell, you know, he certainly puts a lot of effort into it because each time somehow this guy manages to top himself. So I thought this was just fantastic. Corporate Kane is back as the director of operations. I'd rather hear Corporate Kane than Demon Kane on my TV every week, so thank God for that. It's still lazy writing, okay, that he just goes back to his old character from 4 months ago without any sort of explanation. It is lazy, it is dumb, but it's still better than Demon Kane. He put Roman Reigns in a handicap match against Rybacksel. Rybacksel lost by DQ when they, get this, rammed Reigns' shoulder into the post on the outside. Yes, they were disqualified for this horrendous act. Remember that John Cena and Randy Orton can manhandle the entire Raw roster, 17-on-2. But Roman Reigns cannot beat Rybacksel. And yes, I know that match was 6 years ago, but it still aggravates me. After the match, Reigns laid out both Ryback and Curtis Axel with his moves. So I don't know why they couldn't just have him beat them. You know, it's like, does this finish really do anything to protect Rybacksel? Is the logic there? Well, Rybacksel actually has had a few wins recently, and we don't really have any other tag teams. We might want to build them up for a title match at some point, so we can't beat them. so let's just have them get DQ'd. Meanwhile, Roman Reigns left them laying with a spear and a Superman punch, and they were laid out like they were dead. Does it change anything at all? They were still left laying. Why couldn't you just have Reigns win the match? At least he's actually on the card at SummerSlam. He's got one of the you know, top three matches, four matches maybe on the show, I guess, depending on where you slot Ambrose and Rollins. Renee Young interviewed Roman in the ring. He asked her, "What is a viper when you knock its fangs down its throat?" "A worthless little worm." That's what he called Randy Orton. A worthless little worm. Ugh. They're killing this guy with this dialogue. Can you imagine if they scripted this stuff for The Rock when he was first breaking through? I mean, he's The Rock, so he would have been okay, but not everybody is The Rock. Not everybody can be The Rock. Although I did like the Miz TV segment from SmackDown. I did actually catch part of SmackDown this week, and I caught the Miz TV segment that opened the show with Roman Reigns. My favorite Miz TV segment of all... Actually, you know what? I take that back. That's not true. My second favorite Miz TV segment of all time, this was, when Roman Reigns punched the Miz right in the face. And if that wasn't a stiff blow that connected, then Roman Reigns throws the best work punch in WWE today. He cold cocked this guy right in the face. His face jiggled. His glasses went flying off his face. He fell out of his chair. It was awesome. It was fantastic. I didn't stick around to see the main event, so I don't know how their match turned out. But that was awesome. And by the way, for those of you wondering, what's the first greatest Miz TV segment of all time? There was an episode of Raw last year, I think it was last year, where Brock Lesnar came out and destroyed the Miz and threw furniture around. And that still to this day is the best Miz TV segment of all time. I wish they would incorporate footage of that into the opening for the show, but I guess that's asking too much. Seth Rollins beat Job Van Dam with the curb stomp, another loss for RVD. Although, again, I think he'll redeem himself with a win over the even bigger loser, that is Cesaro, at SummerSlam. After the match, Rollins grew suspicious of a giant gift box on the stage. They had all these presents for Hulk Hogan's birthday party, which were never open, by the way. So he's staring at this giant birthday box, this gift box, and he's kind of poking at it. And then he says, "Nah, he's not in there." And he turns to walk away, and sure as shit, out of the box pops Dean Ambrose. Man in a box. They brawl to ringside. Rollins ends up escaping through the crowd. Dean gets on the mic. He dropped a $9.99 plug for the network. Don't do that. You know, the network turned heel last week. Don't let the stink of that rub off on Dean Ambrose, please. We got some commercials for some new Slam City episodes. Unemployed wrestlers forced to get real jobs. So there you go. TNA coming to the WWE Network. We also got lots of celebrity birthday wishes for Hulk Hogan throughout this show. One of them was from AJ Hawk, who plays for the Green Bay Packers. He referred to Hogan as the King of Wrestling, and had the best line of any of these segments. He said, "We've watched you our whole lives, and now I show your clips on YouTube to my little kids growing up." I wonder how that slipped past Vince McMahon. You know, someone on Raw talking about watching classic Hulk Hogan matches on YouTube and not on the WWE Network. I thought that was funny. Then we had an abomination of a segment. We had Stephanie McMahon introducing Daniel Bryan's physical therapist, Megan Miller, who, by the way, is a wrestler. She wrestles up in Canada. She was trained by Lance Storm at his school up in Calgary. Looked an awful lot like the actress who played Claire Lynch in TNA, a fact that was not lost on all of you since Claire Lynch began trending worldwide on Twitter. Shockingly, WWE did not put that in their little Twitter trending box on the screen. Not only did this woman resemble Claire Lynch, this storyline seemed oddly similar. She claimed to be having an affair with Daniel Bryan. Her boyfriend left her. You know, Brie Bella comes out to confront this woman, and then she slaps her and tackles Stephanie to the mat. They rolled around for a little bit until they were all broken up by officials. Stephanie says, "I don't want to wait until SummerSlam. You and I are going to have a match tonight." of all the angles for WWE to copy off of TNA, and make no mistake, they blatantly copied a TNA angle here. They went and picked the Claire Lynch storyline. I almost feel like when they do stuff like that, and they've done that before, you know, this is not the first time they've taken an idea from TNA. TNA certainly holds the record for ideas and stuff that they've stolen from WWE, but it's not like it doesn't work both ways. I almost feel like when they do stuff like this, it's in their mind that they say, okay, TNA did this and it was god-awful. To show how much better we are than them, we're going to take their shitty angle and actually turn it into something that can be good or could make money. And in this case, that's not true. That could not be further from the truth. This was awful. This was terrible. This was tabloid shit that this angle did not need because it was already getting a reaction. The angle was fine. I was into it. You didn't have to go and do this. Bret Hart and Vince McMahon, WrestleMania 26. You have how many years of bad blood and backstory to build that match up? You don't have to do anything. You don't have to have a single writer involved in anything having to do with the Bret Hart-Vince McMahon match at WrestleMania that year. You could have taken Bret, you could have taken Vince, and you could have let them map the whole thing out and cut promos on each other and show footage from Montreal over and over and over again in the aftermath of Montreal, and that would have been enough. But even then, they couldn't help themselves. They had Bret Hart get hit by a car. Remember that? And John Cena came to my leg! His leg was all mangled, and of course in the end, it came out he took the cast off during the contract signing. You know, Vince figured, hey, the guy's hurt. Of course, I'll sign a contract to wrestle you. And then Bret said, well, I'm not really hurt, and ha-ha, very clever. It's like, no, it's just that sports entertainment nonsense that it doesn't need. This was similar. You didn't need this stupid shit. Even Daniel Bryan thinks this angle is shit. He said as much in an interview with IGN this week. They asked him about the Bree Stephanie storyline taking what they called an interesting twist last Monday. And Brian's awesome. Brian hears this and he asked them if by interesting they meant stupid. He called it groan-worthy. He said he didn't think it added anything to the story. He called it a flaw in the story. Daniel Bryan is 100% correct. And I love the fact that he just doesn't give a shit. You know, he's doing this interview, and he basically comes out and he trashes Stephanie McMahon's angle. And says, yeah, not that he hated the angle, but just what happened on Monday night. He basically said it's shit. It was stupid, and that's exactly what it was. Jack Swagger beat Cesaro with the Patriot Lock. Pretty good match here. Story was Cesaro working over Swagger's injured ribs. He even tweaked his uppercut, where he propelled Swagger up into the air. But on the way down, instead of hitting an uppercut, he targeted the ribs. So this was good, but, you know, Swagger's wrestling on the pay-per-view. At the time, Cesaro didn't even have a match. At least now he's on the pre-show. So the right guy won here. And we got a pre-recorded sit-down interview with Bray Wyatt and Chris Jericho, moderated by Michael Cole for all of 5 seconds before Bray sent him away. Told him to get lost. I like this. I think it got lost by the time the show was over. People really weren't talking about it. But I wish they would do more promos like this for big matches. Jericho mostly just sat there in his suit, listening to Bray, with this comical, angry expression on his face. He looked like 2008 No Country for Old Men Chris Jericho when he was doing that gimmick at the time. That's what he looked like here. I thought Wyatt was the star here. The big takeaway from his promo was this part. I wrote it down. He said, there are no consequences for my actions. I have no conscience. I do not heed to the laws of mankind. I do not believe in heaven or hell. Matter of fact, I hate everything this whole damn world ever created, including me. For the people who often complain that Bray Wyatt's promos are hard to follow, they don't make any sense, they're, you know, unintelligible or whatever, he was pretty clear and straightforward here, I thought. Pretty powerful stuff. I don't even remember what Jericho said. Bray totally overshadowed and outshined him here, which I think was how it was designed, to give Bray the lion's share of the speaking time. The one criticism I have, and it has nothing to do with either Bray Wyatt or Chris Jericho, It has to do with Kevin Dunn and the production team. I really wish they would cut the crowd audio out of segments like this when you have a backstage sit-down, pre-recorded deal, especially for a serious match. It really hurts these things to hear people in the background, especially catcalling or saying boring or cracking a joke at the wrong moment when it's not really called for. You know, back in the day, they never would have crowd noise in the background for stuff like this. I'm talking back like 20 years ago. You know, and actually, probably even less than that. I'm pretty sure that Rock and Austin sit down with Jim Ross before WrestleMania 17. Remember, they were sitting in the locker room. You saw the lockers behind them. I'm pretty sure that didn't have crowd noise in it either. I'm pretty sure they cut it out. You know, you're going to have people chanting stupid stuff or getting bored or restless or whatever. We don't need to hear that. It's more effective if you just cut out all of the background noise so people are focused squarely on what these two guys are saying. That's just my two cents. I got my fill of Eva Marie the week before on NXT, so of course she had to be back on TV again this week, this time on Raw against AJ Lee in a non-title match, and she won! Paige's music hit, she skipped around the ring, this distracted AJ. We got the dreaded distraction roll-up finish, so at least we hit our quota for the week. You know, because every babyface in this company is completely and utterly stupid that they let themselves be distracted by this. Match went a little over a minute. Now, I didn't notice this the first time I watched it. I went back and I watched it again, and I know you guys, many of you guys, are aware of this. I thought this was hilarious. So, Eva Marie wins the match. She rolls out of the ring. She's blowing kisses to the camera. She's fine. Paige then cuts a little promo on AJ on the ramp, and the camera cuts back to AJ. She's not very happy. She looks like she's about to snap. So what does she do? She goes outside, and she attacks Eva Marie. Only thing is, before attacking Eva Marie, we see Eva Marie down on the ground, selling that she's hurt. I would love to know what happened in the 60 seconds between her blowing that kiss and her nursing an injury that caused her to be down on the ground. I would tell you to go back and see it for yourself, but I would never ask you people to go back and watch an Eva Marie match. So just take my word for it. It was completely ridiculous. John Cena came out for a promo. I always shudder when that happens because you never know what you're going to get. You never know what kind of John Cena promo you're going to get. But he was in full sell the network, sell the pay-per-view, sell this match mode this week, and I thought he was really good. The second really good promo from Cena in the last few weeks hyping up this match, to where he had most of the people in the building cheering for him and chanting his name when it was over, and that's not an easy thing to accomplish. He called Brock Lesnar the most selfish SOB to ever walk into a WWE locker room. He said this with Hulk Hogan backstage. He said Brock Lesnar could have diverticulitis, hepatitis, laryngitis. Right now, it's more like punk bitch-itis. I would love to know how one gets tested for such a disease. Then he did something that played into everybody's hands. I actually thought it was kind of lame. I thought it was the worst part about this promo here. He's done this before, where he panders to the people who are just dying to see him turn heel by asking them, if this might be the time that he turns, you know. He used that word, by the way, turn. Will I turn this Sunday at SummerSlam? That's almost as bad as the Russo shit where, you know, you have a guy out there on TV talking about the script and stuff and stupid shit like this, breaking down that fourth wall that you should never, ever do on TV, you know. So he's talking about people want to know, you know, when do I stop being about the wristbands and the Kmart shoes, and just unleash hell. He said this, by the way, on the same night he debuted new red-colored gear, which I thought was kind of funny. He said, at SummerSlam, we're going to see a side of John Cena that we've never seen before. Now, I know what they were doing here. Teasing a Cena heel turn. It's like catnip for wrestling fans. It's the best way I can describe it. You ever see what happens when you give catnip to a cat? Seriously. It's the best thing ever. If you get a cat for no other reason, you got to get a cat so you can play with it and give it catnip. It's like crack cocaine for cats. They go nuts for it. The Cena heel turn is like catnip for wrestling fans. Okay, it's an easy hook. You know, I always envisioned a John Cena heel turn if it was ever going to happen. Being done either the way Hogan did it in 96, where it's a shocking thing that people aren't really expecting on that night, or it's a thing where he loses a match to somebody and just snaps. He just loses his cool and goes crazy, and we see a jealous side of John Cena that we haven't seen before. Had they not done the cash-in last year with Randy Orton, and had they done a better job of building up somebody to be on the same level as John Cena, the match with Daniel Bryan at SummerSlam last year, just to use that as an example, would have been a great place to do that. I never envisioned it being John Cena comes out on TV and starts saying, "Hey, everyone wants me to be bad, so you may get your wish on Sunday." I don't like that. It was still a good promo. I just could have done without the heel shtick, especially since he's not turning heel, so why tease it? He's teasing that we're going to see his mean streak on Sunday. I get that. But that's not what they wanted you to think here, and I think the way they did it was dumb. Brie Bella came out dressed to wrestle Stephanie. Stephanie did not come out dressed for combat. Reason being, Megan Miller, we're told, decided to press charges against Brie for slapping her earlier in the show, which resulted in Brie Bella getting arrested. First Stephanie, now Brie. And on Impact this week, they arrested EC3, Spud, Rhino. These wrestlers are setting a bad example for our youth. We had Heath Slater beat Dolph Ziggler by countout. Miz was standing on top of the announce desk doing commentary. Ziggler went after him, couldn't make it back inside in time. He ended up laying out Slater anyway with the zigzag after the match. Randy Orton beat Sheamus in a dull match with a cool finish. Orton catching Sheamus in midair, coming off the top with an RKO. Place popped huge. Randy Orton took time to pose just like he was a babyface before pinning Sheamus. It was better than their match the night after WrestleMania last year, in that at least this one wasn't hijacked by the crowd, but I have a very tough time getting into Randy Orton-Sheamus matches because I largely just find them boring. So then it was time for the Hulk Hogan birthday bash. By the way, I read the statement from Dana Warrior, Ultimate Warrior's widow, directed at Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan did a video interview with Grantland and was asked about the Warrior's final days and apparently said some stuff that she didn't take too kindly to. And in her statement, she mentioned that Hogan was the only person affiliated with WWE who did not call or send a card after Warrior's death. So their daughters asked their mom, you know, why didn't Hulk check in on us like everyone else? And she said, she had the mother of all burns here for Hulk Hogan. She said, "Well, there's no camera in our mailbox or in the house when we get our calls." Wow. Someone get that man to a hospital for third-degree burns. That was a rough statement right there. Anyway, Jimmy Hart, Mean Gene Okerlund in the ring, brought out Hogan. They paid tribute to him with a special video set to Bob Dylan's Forever Young. Can't wait to see what crappy song they dub over this with when the episode pops up on the network. Ric Flair came out, Paul Orndorff, to his WCW music that I think nobody in the crowd recognized. Maybe two people did. Rowdy Roddy Piper, The Outsiders, Hall and Nash in their NWO gear for their little NWO reunions. They gave Scott Hall a live mic. He did his survey. Hulk Hogan ripped off the red and yellow shirt to reveal the black and white. Kevin Nash started singing Happy Birthday. Was interrupted by, "Oh shit, it's Brock Lesnar." He goes nose to nose with Hogan, revealing that Hulk Hogan is actually just as big, if not bigger, than Brock Lesnar. It's a good thing Lesnar did not go, you know, nose to chest with Kevin Nash. Then he really would have been exposed. Lesnar told Hogan, "Party's over, Grandpa," which I thought was just a fantastic line. I laughed heartily at that. Just great. It's such a contrast to see what Hulk Hogan allows WWE to get away with when it comes to stuff like this. You know, just the mere fact that Brock Lesnar, they would have somebody out there referring to Hulk Hogan as an old man and basically calling him old and washed up on TV. In TNA, he never would have allowed any of that. You know, in TNA, his last appearance ever with TNA, he wouldn't even let them make him look bad. His last appearance in TNA, which one day will be the book cover to the death of TNA, I've said this before, is Dixie Carter, the president of the company, on her knees hugging Hulk Hogan's leg So even in his exit, they would, you know, because he had 100% creative control. They had no choice but to do what he wanted, you know, them to do. But yet in WWE, it's just amazing. It's amazing to see the contrast of how things were with him in TNA and what he lets them get away with in WWE. Because to him, image is everything. You know, to a lot of those guys, image is everything. And it's in a lot of other situations, they would not allow something like that to be scripted. But here's Brock Lesnar calling him an old man. That brought out John Cena. The rest of the roster, by the way, was just standing on stage. They thought better of going anywhere near Brock, so at least they have some brains. But John Cena finally came out to save somebody. He came out to somebody's rescue. Not something we see very often from him. He was ready to throw down, but being the great bully that he is, Brock backed off. They did get audio of him shouting, "I'm a mercenary," right before they went off the air, which sounded really lame, but again, that's WWE dialogue. I like this. They had a lot of star power in the ring. We got a bit of nostalgia, which is nice in doses. Not every single week, like we've been seeing in TNA with the ECW stuff. But in the end, what I liked about this is they turned it into a way to drive interest in the SummerSlam main event. It's not like, you know, why are these people doing a Hulk Hogan birthday party 6 days before SummerSlam and they should be promoting the pay-per-view? Well, they did that to pop a rating, but they weaved it into, as a way to hype the main event, which I thought was actually very clever and very effective. You know, they made a decision. John Cena and Brock Lesnar would not touch during the build-up to this match, and I think that's fine. I think that's great. Hopefully it'll make more people want to subscribe to the network to see the match and to see them touch for the first time on there. Now, the Cena-Lesnar special, I think I briefly mentioned it earlier. It was a half-hour special on the WWE Network when Raw ended. It was done in the vein of almost like a UFC fight special when they're building up a big fight. Again, I would love to see them do more stuff like this. You can't do it every single month, but every few months, you know, when there's a really big-time main event match, they absolutely should do stuff like this. My favorite Brock Lesnar quote from this special was they asked him about Extreme Rules. They actually brought up the first match they had when Brock came back, and they asked him what happened because Brock lost the match. And Brock's answer was, "I don't know what the fuck happened at Extreme Rules." Because I got hit with a fucking chain. And of course they bleeped it when he said that. But that's exactly what he said. I got hit with a fucking chain. I don't know what the F happened in that match. And all I could do is sit there and think to myself, me either, Brock. Me either. I still can't figure it out. But to go back to that final segment on Raw, though, before we move on, I have to make mention of this. Because it is something I mentioned last week that upset me. And still does. Yeah, I'm still angry about it. Was WWE seemingly dropping the whole Xavier Woods, Big E, Kofi Kingston stable or storyline, whatever it was that they started, they just dropped it cold. And it makes for bad television that you actually... It's one thing to have an idea. God knows they've had plenty of ideas that have never seen the light of day. Vince has changed his mind, you know, plans change. But they actually started it. They started it on TV, and it went, you know... It went in so much as we saw both guys, or all three, I should say, together. Even that one time on Raw, they were just standing in the back watching on a monitor. They didn't say anything. This went on for like 2 weeks, and then nothing. Done. Big E's a babyface on SmackDown getting beat by Rusev, and Woods is doing nothing, and Kofi's doing nothing. It's just right back to the status quo. And, you know, do we know for sure that it's been dropped? No. It's possible they could revive it when SummerSlam is over. I don't think they will. I do think it's dead. Big E went on Twitter earlier in the week. He said, "Big ups to @FlatbushZombies and @Whale for working on music for us. Almost." I love how he stuck the word almost in there at the end. And then Whale, who apparently worked on a song that we're never going to hear for this new supposed faction, he went on Twitter himself and said, "So they're not doing Big E, Kofi, and Xavier as a faction anymore." So that tells me right there that even the people involved in this think that it's dead. Or maybe they were told flat out that it's not happening. And, you know, it sucks. It sucks because I was interested to see where it was going to go. It sucks because they're doing nothing with any of those guys. And it might have been the best shot that Xavier Woods had to actually be something and have a meaningful role on the roster. Because, look, he's a small guy. And I just don't see them doing anything with him. He's a guy who I could see in the next round of cuts, whatever that may be, that they cut him. He's expendable. I mean, most guys on the roster are expendable. You know, they're just going to keep going no matter who you are. But he's really expendable because he's not doing anything. At least this would have given these guys a purpose. That's what bothered me more than anything else about this whole thing. And now with this stuff going on in Ferguson, Missouri, which I'm sure most of you are aware of, for those of you who aren't aware, maybe you live outside this country, there was a young black teenager that was shot dead, unarmed teenager that was shot dead by a cop in Ferguson, Missouri, and it's really incited a lot of anger, and there's been, you know, rioting and protesting and looting, and it's been an awful situation, I think, from all sides. And people are tweeting me saying, well, do you think now they're going to drop the angle because of the Ferguson thing? People don't understand here. The Ferguson thing happened after, you know, the stable was teased. And even the decision, if it was made, to drop it and not do it anymore, that happened before any of this stuff in Ferguson went down. The stuff in Ferguson, to me, is the nail in the coffin, because even if there was a shot of putting these guys together and going in the direction that they were going in before, now there ain't no chance in hell. I mean, you could take these three guys, they happen to be three black wrestlers, and put them together and make it not about race. They don't have to be a militant black faction. It could just be three dudes who are being held down, who are being held back, who are banding together to try to make something of themselves. But at the end of the day, people are going to look and they're going to say, hey, it's three black guys, so it must be a new nation of domination. And they probably know that. And now with the stuff in Ferguson, you could forget about this. This thing is, I don't need anybody to tell me that this thing is dead. Now they can't do it. I don't see how, they could, but I don't see how they do it now. At least before, had they already started it and then this happened, they could have just taken it in a different direction. Again, it doesn't have to be about being black. It doesn't have to be about race. You could have just had three guys who are just sick and tired of being held down and just, you know, take it in that direction. So, you know, it's not a case where, well, it's a good thing WWE didn't do it. No, they don't get a pass, okay? The Ferguson thing happened afterwards. Do not give WWE a pass on this. They do not deserve a pass. They made a stupid decision. It makes for bad television. This thing just happened to occur after that. And now, like I said, it's probably the nail in the coffin. If there was any even remote hope of it still happening, I think that pretty much washed away with this whole situation. And it's a shame. More than anything else, for those three guys, I feel bad for them because they were probably excited too. I wonder, you know, a guy like Kofi is probably thinking to himself, hey, I'm excited to try the heel thing. And, you know, I'm ready to give it a shot. You know, it's a challenge for somebody like him. And it looks like it's just back to the status quo. And most of all, I feel bad for those three guys. Kevin Steen has officially signed with WWE. The announcement was made this past week. They showed a photo of him online posing with Triple H at the NXT Arena. Apparently that photo was taken a couple of months ago. They've been holding it. They've been waiting. They wanted to make the announcement on the same day that the WWE Network launched in Canada, which it did on Tuesday. And by the way, I've been getting a lot of less than stellar reviews on that from you guys up north on the network in Canada so far. To show how high they are on Kevin Steen, and this was a note that was mentioned in the most recent Observer newsletter, reportedly Dean Ambrose was told not to do Kevin Steen's running cannonball into the corner move anymore, because they want that to be a new move for Steen when he comes to the main roster. And if that's true, if they're already thinking about Steen on the main roster, because he is going to hit NXT first, the question, of course, is how long do they keep him there? I think that's got to be a positive sign for Kevin Steen in terms of, A, they have plans for the guy, and B, maybe he won't spend too much time after all at NXT. So he's in. Again, not exactly a big secret, nor was it when Devitt, you know, when they made the announcement about Devitt, when they made the announcement about Kenta, but all three are now officially announced. They are in. Steen is reporting to NXT, to the Performance Center, I should say, on August 25th, so next week. I think that's next Tuesday, I want to say. Maybe next Monday. He'll be reporting to the Performance Center, so he is in. NXT results for this past week. Prince Pretty, finally getting his title match against Adrian Neville on this show. We start, though, with another first-round match in the NXT Tag Team Tournament, putting the Vaudevillains against Bull Dempsey and Mojo Rawley. Winners to meet Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy in the next round. Bull was running wild when Mojo blind-tagged himself into the match, which Bull was not happy about. And rightfully so. He ended up getting caught with the rolling senton, swanton combo and pinned by the Vaudevillains. So they advance. This does not make Bull happy. I don't think anything makes Bull happy. He always looks like he's in a bad mood. That's why they call him Bull. So Dempsey beat the piss out of Rawley afterwards, left him laying to chance of thank you, Bull. Even the NXT Universe does not like Mojo Rawley, poor guy. Bayley and Sasha Banks to determine the new number one contender to Charlotte's NXT Women's Championship. They started out with chain wrestling. They traded a series of rolling near falls, a la Dean Malenko and Eddie Guerrero back in the day. This was a good match. This was a really good match. They went through two commercial breaks, so they gave them time. Finish was pretty cool, too. Sasha went for her new finish. She calls it the Boss Lock, which is a backstabber, and Sasha then immediately rolls. It's almost like she rolls over and turns it into a crossface in one fell swoop. She turns it into a crossface on her opponent. Only this time, Bayley was able to maneuver in such a way where Sasha got her shoulders pinned to the mat. She kind of rolled her over. Sasha, even though she had the move applied, got her shoulders pinned. So Bayley will challenge Charlotte for the title, I presume, at TakeOver 2, Electric Boogaloo, next month. We had another first-round tag team match in the tournament, Kalisto and Sin Cara against the new team of Buddy Murphy and Wesley Blake. Kalisto won it for his team, so they meet Sami Zayn and Adam Rose in the next round. Someone posted on my Facebook page earlier in the week an idea for Adam Rose getting hurt and Sami Zayn being left without a partner. And his new partner turns out to be Kevin Steen. I actually love that idea. It's the only way I could justify Zayn and Rose being put together as a tag team and then beating Tyson Kidd and Justin Gabriel last week like they did. If they were to make it all the way to the finals, let's say, but Adam Rose gets taken out by the Ascension or something before the match, something happens, and it looks like it's going to be a handicap match and Zayn's all by himself, and all of a sudden, Steen walks out and they win the titles, they beat the Ascension. You know, they're the ones to finally dethrone the Ascension and pave the way for the Ascension then to move on and make their main roster debut, which has been rumored for a while now. You know, that's an idea that I can get behind. I assume that does not happen, and instead we wait for, Stephen Keen to make his NXT debut. Maybe they'll call him Kelvin Stream, something like that. That's probably more realistic. Veronica Lane, new diva. I don't know how new she is. I think she may have been on NXT a few months ago doing backstage interviews, but then she disappeared. I think she got hurt. I think that's what happened. I think she's been out nursing a knee injury. But anyway, Veronica Lane is back. She was backstage interviewing Sylvester Lefort and Marcus Louis, the Legionnaires, quite possibly the most god-awful boring team I've ever seen. This was my first time hearing Marcus Louis on the microphone. He is horrible. And they're still talking about Kaz and Enzo, which worries me. I swear to God, if they take Kaz and Enzo out of this freaking tournament next week, just to feud with these two schmucks, I am going to be pissed. So there have been four NXT champions in history. Seth Rollins, Big E, Bo Dallas, and Adrian Neville. Question is, could Tyler Breeze become number five? Crowd was silent for the first half of the match here between Breeze and Neville. It was like a Japanese crowd almost. Very respectful in that they weren't chanting stupid shit like they did a few weeks ago during the women's match when they got bored. They weren't chanting stupid things just to get themselves over, but they weren't really reacting much to anything. Then things picked up, and we got some great near falls. Tyson Kidd was out there, by the way, at the announce desk. He wasn't saying anything. He was observing. So you just knew a screwjob finish was coming. Breeze caught Neville with a tornado DDT that has to be seen to be believed. Adrian Neville did the most ridiculous sell job on a DDT that I have ever seen, and that includes all those great pile driver and DDT sell jobs that Rob Van Dam has done over the years, going back to the old ECW. He got drilled into the mat and literally flipped over onto his feet, almost like he was going to no-sell it and just pop right back up. But instead, he ended up just doing a face plant. So he just did a complete flip over and landed flat on his face. It was just so great. I'm describing it here, but you really should just watch it for yourself. It wasn't great enough, apparently, since he kicked out of the pin attempt. So it was great, but not that great. Action spilled outside. Neville hit a dive out onto Breeze. This brought Tyson Kidd to ringside. Although still in the crowd. He was kind of behind the barricade in the crowd, though. And Adrian Neville, spotting him, drops him with a super kick. And for what? Guy didn't do anything wrong. He just kicked him in the face for no reason. He paid the price for that a couple of minutes later when he went for the red arrow on Breeze, and Tyson Kidd shoved him off the top rope for the DQ. This greatly upset Tyler Breeze, who was more than holding his own. Probably was well on his way to winning the championship, and Tyson Kidd screwed him out of that. So the two heels ended up brawling around for a little bit. Adrian Neville came over to join in the brawl, but then he got beat down by both Kidd and Breeze. This brought out Sami Zayn to make the save for Adrian Neville, and it appears to set up a four-way for the championship at TakeOver next month with Neville, Breeze, Zayn, and Kidd. I endorse that match. I hope that's the direction they're going in, because that match just, it needs to happen. The DQ was lame. I'm okay with it because it sets up a bigger match where we will hopefully get a decisive finish. I was kind of shocked they had the title match on this show. I was figuring they were going to hold off until TakeOver anyway, and so they did it for the reason, I assume, of setting up the four-way. I'm just assuming here that that's the match that we end up getting. But this was really good. You know, Tyler Breeze continues to impress in these big matches. Adrian Neville's great. And again, when Adrian Neville, when you see him wrestling on NXT, if you're not familiar with his work on the indies, just know that you're only seeing like a small part of what that guy is capable of. He's only scratching the surface. You know, when you go down there, you have to slow it down. There's a lot of things they don't let you do. We're only seeing a small part of what this guy is really capable of. But Tyler Breeze, I feel like, is a guy that all people see, if you're not really familiar with NXT, is a guy doing, you know, a stupid gimmick. It's not money. It's just, you know, he's being a chicken shit heel. It's, you know, we've seen this before. That may well all be true, but he's actually a really good wrestler. And I'm happy they have him showing, you know, a more serious side. He's not just playing comedy the whole match, running away. Oh, don't hit my face. I guess he can't do that now anyway, since Miz stole his fucking gimmick. But Breeze is really good. I like what I'm seeing from him on NXT. He's one of the featured performers now. And this dovetails into one other thing here with NXT that I want to talk about before we move on. And that is Bo Dallas. So a lot of stories out on the web this week, on the dirt sheets and all that kind of stuff, that WWE has allegedly already given up on Bo Dallas. They've already given up on him. And I think we could kind of tell that because they had him lose to R-Truth a couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago maybe it was now, on Raw. He had this undefeated streak going that had so much comedic potential. And they killed it. They killed it and had R-Truth be the one to beat him. R-Truth, who has not done anything significant, I think, since he and Miz teamed up against The Rock and John Cena at Survivor Series in 2011. And they did it seemingly to start showing a meaner side of Bo Dallas. He's got a real mean streak in him. I think they had a rematch on SmackDown that week, and I don't remember if Truth beat him again. Maybe it was a DQ, but like Bo Dallas beat him down. And I thought to myself, you know what? I still hate that they broke the streak. There was so much potential there. But okay, maybe they're finally going to take the character in a more serious direction and move him, you know, into an actual feud, an actual program. Where has Bo Dallas been since then? It's kind of similar to the Big E, Xavier Woods, Kofi stuff, right? Similar to that, where it's almost like they started in a certain direction, but now we haven't even seen the guy. Maybe he's been on SmackDown. SmackDown doesn't count. In the eyes of most people, SmackDown does not count. It is the B show. I would argue that SmackDown is maybe the C show. I watch NXT. I don't watch SmackDown. But Raw is the A show. Raw is what matters. And the guy hasn't even been on Raw. So it was never about giving him a mean streak. It was never about any of that. It was about, we've given up on the guy. Yeah, I could believe that. I could believe that those rumors are probably true. Because I saw it with my own two eyes. They ended the streak for no reason and had nothing for him. And now he's not even on the A show. He's not even showing up on television. And it pisses me off. Because no matter what you thought of the Bo Dallas character, just like Tyler Breeze, if Tyler Breeze is ever promoted to the main roster, there's going to be a lot of people who look at the guy and they probably shake their heads and think, I don't get it. What's the big deal? Hopefully when they see him working, they'll understand at least some of the love for the guy. He's actually really good. But the problem is, I don't want to see Tyler Breeze brought up to the main roster if Bo Dallas is an example of what's in his future. And that goes for a lot of the great guys. Sami Zayn is a guy who I think is probably earmarked for the main roster sooner rather than later. I would like to think that he's good enough where they can't possibly give up on Sami Zayn. But then I say to myself, can they? Of course they can. They've given up on guys before who were good because they don't have any patience. They have no patience. They have zero patience at all. Why would you give up that quickly on a guy? Why wouldn't you just ride the wave of that undefeated streak? Let Bo Dallas hit 22-0 and start gloating on television that, hey, I beat the Undertaker streak. The Undertaker only went 21-0 before he lost. I went 22-0. And then, hopefully at that point, if you want to break the streak, that's fine. I mean, my idea for Sami Zayn to bring him up to the main roster was that he should have been the one to break the streak. Here's this guy being brought up that a lot of people probably don't know. Not everybody's going to know who Sami Zayn is. And Bo Dallas can be all like, oh, hey, little buddy, how you doing? I see you're getting your first shot here on Raw, Good luck. And, Sami Zayn, ever the underdog, gets a win. People go crazy. They love it. They cheer for him. And Bo Dallas can't believe it. And he attacks him. And at least it gives Bo Dallas now something to do. And it gives Sami Zayn something to do right out of the gate. You got these two NXT guys now who are going to feud on the main roster. And you go from there. I mean, that's just an idea. I'm just spitballing here. But to hear that they've already given up on Bo Dallas is just, it's infuriating. It is absolutely infuriating to me. Because I thought, foolish of me, that the reports of Triple H not wanting to bring anybody up from NXT unless there were long-term plans in place for them. As naive, I guess, as I allowed myself to be, I believe that when I read that. I believe that that was the case because NXT is Triple H's baby. I'm sure Triple H wants to see these guys succeed. You think a guy like Triple H, who oversees developmental, wants Bo Dallas, who was the NXT champion for how many days? They bantered about how 200 days, 300 days as the NXT champion, and this guy comes to the main roster, and now they've given up on him, supposedly? That reflects poorly on Triple H. I'm sure it's not his decision. The buck stops with Vince McMahon. And this guy had something. Even if you're not a big Bo Dallas fan, he doesn't have to be a world heavyweight champion, for crying out loud. He has to be a solid mid-card act. If he's a comedy act, then make him a comedy act. If that's what he's good at, then fine. But to hear that they've already given up on the guy, it's been 2 months. It's been 2 months. What are you giving up so quickly for? Do you know how many guys that you and I, as wrestling fans back in the 90s and the 80s, some of you go back even further than that, can you imagine how many of those guys who went on to be legends and Hall of Famers would never have made it to that level? We wouldn't even know their names today if they came up today and they were given up on as quickly as these guys are being given up on now. I mean, just think about it. Think about all those guys that have gone on to be some of the biggest names in the history of this industry. And it never would have happened had they come up now, or had the mentality been the same then, where it was all about television, ratings, and everything else, and if the guy didn't click and didn't get over within 3 weeks, into the scrap heap you go. It's kind of like now with what they look for when they bring guys into developmental. And you think about guys like Dusty Rhodes back in the day, or a Harley Race, even a Ric Flair. Do you really honestly think those guys would have gotten a second look had they tried out now to be, a wrestler in WWE? Of course not. Or even if they were brought in, they never would have made it past a certain level. Yeah, the mentality has changed so much, and I think it's destructive is what it is. So I look at a guy like Tyler Breeze, who I rave about every week. I'm into the character. I think he's a good wrestler. I'm into the act. I love it. It's one of my favorite parts of the show. And the goal for NXT is always, well, can't wait to see what they have in store for these guys when they make it to the main roster. Making it to the main roster is like the holy grail, right? And I'm sure these guys want to get to the main roster because they want to be on TV. They want to make more money. They want to succeed. You know, they're very ambitious. I'm sure that's how they feel. As a fan, I look at this and I say to myself, I don't want Tyler Breeze on Raw or SmackDown. I want him to stay right where he is. I want Sami Zayn to stay right where he is. And with all these guys they're bringing in now, Kevin Steen, Devitt, Kenta, and the guys they have with Breeze and Neville and Zayn, okay, and some of the tag teams, Kaz and Enzo, they have a third, it's like a third brand that they've developed now. I almost want them to just stay right where they are and just enjoy NXT as a brand all unto itself. Because it's obvious to me that when they bring these guys up, for every five guys they bring up, one or two are going to make it. And it's not because these guys aren't any good. One or two will make it in spite of the shit that they have to go up against when they make it to the main roster. And I don't know why it has to be that way. These guys work for you. They belong to you. They're signed to a contract for your company. You are sabotaging these people. For what purpose? Please, someone explain that to me. It just doesn't make any sense. It just does not make any sense to me at all. Thank you guys for taking time out of your day to listen to The Sound Off. I get questions from people asking, how can I support the podcast? Well, the best way to support the show is simple. Just keep listening each and every week. Keep spreading the word about it to friends and family and retweet or share links to the episodes on Twitter and Facebook. But beyond that, you can contribute by making a PayPal donation or by signing up for a free 30-day trial of the Audible.com service. Making a PayPal donation is simple. Just log on to thesolemonster.com and you'll see the PayPal donation box on the right-hand side of the page. Enter whatever amount you'd like and click the Make a Donation button. That's it. Or sign up for a free Audible trial by entering our custom URL, audibletrial.com/solemonster. From there, you can sign up free for 30 days, which helps us out. You get one free audiobook as part of your trial that you get to keep no matter what. You can browse through their library of over 150,000 titles. Listen to your books at home, on the commute to work, at the gym, whenever, wherever. Sign up at audibletrial.com/solemonster or visit thesolemonster.com to make a donation right now. And thank you for supporting The Sound Off. TNA Impact is moving to Wednesday nights, 9 o'clock Eastern Time, 8 Central, starting this week. Likely for the better, with football starting and SmackDown likely moving to Thursdays. Impact this past Thursday was down 300,000 viewers. I think they had about 1.1 million to the previous week's 1.4 million. That is a steep drop, and you can't even really say that it was all from the Dixie table bump. That's why that audience was so big, because if you remember, you know, it did a good number, but the Dixie thing at the end of the show didn't even do the biggest quarter hour on that show. So how much interest there really was in that angle, I'm not sure. But that was a steep drop. And for a show this week that had a main event of the Hardy Boys against Team 3D. And it also came against the first, I think it was the first preseason football game. Season hasn't even started yet, and they're already shedding viewers. So the move is probably for the best. It doesn't indicate that they have a new TV deal. There's still been no announcement. You know, as we get even closer now to September, we get closer to the fall season. UTA is still negotiating a new TV deal or looking for a new home for TNA Impact. And I don't think people are going to really rest easy in that company until they make some sort of formal announcement. They did announce a new set of tapings. I think they're going to be taping Impact and at least one of those one-night-only pay-per-views that they sometimes tape. I think September 16th through the 19th are the dates, and they're going back to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which is where they did the tapings before they started the New York City shows. I guess they like the crowd there, so they're going back to Bethlehem. They may be back to the Manhattan Center at some point. So they're taping TV, which doesn't, again, necessarily mean anything, because they do have international TV deals. It's not just the TV deal here in this country. So if they have contracts in the UK or India and other places like that, then they're obligated to provide new content for those stations, or else they would be in breach of contract. So it doesn't mean anything until they make some sort of announcement, and they're still in limbo right now. But they are moving to Wednesday nights. We'll see. We'll see what happens, if it's a good move or not. If they move to Wednesdays and in a couple of weeks they're pulling in half the audience they were before, then I guess it wasn't a good idea. I expect Impact to be down no matter what this week, just because anytime you move a show to a new network, it's going to lose viewers. I mean, it happened to WWE when they went from USA to TNN and even back to USA. You know, the audience doesn't always follow right away. Look how long it took people to finally realize that Raw was moving to 3 hours permanently. It's like, if you looked at the ratings patterns when that first started, it was obvious that people just, they didn't know. Even though it was drilled into their brain a million times on TV, they just didn't know. You know, people are creatures of habit. So, Impact now on Wednesdays. Rest in peace, Thursday Night Impact. Davey Richards broke his leg at a TNA house show on Friday night. It happened in, Indiana, Pennsylvania is where the show took place. It was the Wolves in a match against D-Von and Mr. Anderson, who was substituting for Bully Ray, who was not there. And it seems like what happened is Richards went for a sliding drop kick to somebody who was outside the ring. Similar move, if not the same move, that Rob Van Dam used when he broke his ankle in a match in the original ECW. I want to say it was against Rhino. For the ECW TV title, when Van Dam was in the middle of his record-breaking reign as ECW television champion. He had to forfeit the title in the end. I think he had it for like 23 months or something like that. So Abyss came out to replace Davey Richards in the match. EC3 came out, attacked Abyss. That left Edwards by himself. He ended up winning the match. It's a shame. You know, he broke his, I think the injury is that he broke his fibula, which is the bone that runs from the knee to the ankle. How severe the break is, I haven't seen any updated reports on that. It's a bad injury no matter what, but I guess the severity, if it's not too severe, he could conceivably be back in 6 to 8 weeks. If it's a really severe break, though, I mean, you broke your freaking leg. I mean, he could be out 3 to 6 months. It really just depends. And if he needs surgery, and I mean, he may need surgery anyway, I don't know. So, tough break, no pun intended, tough break for the Wolves. Eddie Edwards is screwed over also, because, you know, anytime you're in a tag team and something happens to your partner, I mean, look at Conor O'Brien, NXT, right? The original Ascension was not Conor O'Brien or Rick Victor, it was Conor O'Brien and the current Bram in TNA. I forgot his actual name, but whatever name he was using before, he got himself into trouble and with the law, and he got fired. And that left his partner in a lurch. So Conor O'Brien was doing the singles thing for a while on the fast track to nowhere. And then they hooked him up with Rick Victor, and they now are the Ascension, the new Ascension. But what makes it tougher is they're in the middle of this storyline now with Team 3D and the Hardys. So the TNA tapings that I was at last week, we got match one that you're going to be seeing on TV. So spoiler alert. We got match one in a three-match series that was taped that week. Match one was a straight match, then a table match, then a ladder match. The idea is that the first team to win two matches in the series will win the series and will be the tag team champions. I believe each team split victories in the series. So the night that I went to the show, 3D won. I'm guessing that the Hardys won the next night. The Wolves may have won night three, which means there's still one match left in the series that has not yet been taped. And that could wreak havoc on that. I mean, to me, I guess the most obvious thing, I mean, you could plug another third team in there, I guess, but it would make sense that if Davey Richards is not going to be back in time and they have to be stripped of the belts, you have that third match just between the Hardys and the Dudleys, and the winner becomes the new tag team champions. And in that case, I could see them putting the belts on Bully and D-Von so that they're the tag team champions when they get inducted in October at Bound for Glory into the Hall of Fame in Japan. But that, you know, that's down the road. We don't know, again, if they'll have to strip the Wolves or not. My gut tells me they will. I mean, the guy broke his leg. You know, you don't want to rush back from an injury like that. So we'll see what happens. It sucks, but you'll get your fill of Davey Richards on TV because he's in matches that have been taped for TV for the next month, I think. You know, month and a half. So you'll be seeing him over the next several weeks. So Impact on Thursday night was an interesting show. I did pop up again on the show, as many of you pointed out, to the point where I became, I mean, the Facebook memes in our group online, it was just, you know, I have to say, I think it was Halen Lee who put the one together. The one that actually made me laugh out loud, like truly laugh out loud, was the one that was kind of poking fun at the old Audible ad that I used to run here on the podcast, where I talked about, you know, JYD's book, his audio book, sounds interesting. And I ran that ad for far too long before I updated it recently, and it became kind of a running joke. And when I saw that, I just started cracking up. So good job on that. That was the best one I probably saw of the bunch. I'm not quite sure how I feel, again, about being a meme. This is all new to me. But yeah, the camera was on us because Bully Ray came over right to us when he came out in the opening segment, first 5 minutes of the show. And there's Brian Blade and myself and, you know, everybody else who was in our section. Just, you know, Bully Ray was in a jovial mood because he had just put Dixie through a table the week before. And we got plenty of footage and replays of the big table bump. And I have to actually break in here and mention one other thing. This is so TNA. It almost just feels right. So on shoptna.com, they are selling a special collector's plaque that has a certificate of authenticity. It has a little plate that has the date and the location of the event, a photo of Dixie being put through a table, or I should say Bully's ass going through a table with Dixie taking a powerbomb, and a piece of the mat from that night, and a piece of the broken table that Bully's ass broke. And they're selling this. They're selling a plaque with a piece of mat and a piece of table from the bump for $200. $199.99, to be specific. You can own a piece of TNA memorabilia if you have $200 to spare. That in and of itself is completely ridiculous and comical, and if they sell five of them, I would be shocked, especially for that price. If it was $50, I could see people buying it, but not for $200. If you have $200 to spend, people, do not waste it on a TNA plaque with a piece of table from the Dixie Carter bump. Please don't do that. If you do, reevaluate your life. But that being said, that's not even why I bring this up. I bring this up because, and I didn't see anybody else point this out. No website, no tweet from anybody on Twitter when I did a search. I thought to myself, maybe I'm late to the game on this, and I'm noticing something that people noticed a week before I did. I didn't find anything. If you look at the plate that has the date and the location on the plaque, it says the Grand Ballroom. And underneath, which is accurate, by the way, the room in the building is the Grand Ballroom. It's on the upper floor. And underneath it, it says the Manhattan Ballroom. I don't know what the fuck the Manhattan Ballroom is. I've never heard of the Manhattan Ballroom before. It is the Manhattan Center. The Grand Ballroom at the Manhattan Center. How you fuck something like that up, I have no idea. They have a typo on the plaque, which they're selling for $200. If you're selling something for $200, at least get the fucking name of the building right. The Manhattan Ballroom. And somebody tweeted me, I don't think he was joking. He said, it's happened before. TNA must have put something like this out once before. And apparently on that one, they misspelled the word heavyweight. I mean, the quality control that goes into this stuff is just top notch, let me tell you. But I just saw that, and it was the first thing I noticed. I'm surprised nobody else brought it up. I looked at it and I said, wait a minute. The Grand Ballroom at the Manhattan Ballroom. That sounds a little redundant to me. And then I realized, yeah, typo. They fucked up. So back to the opening segment. Bully's out there. He brings out D-Von. They end up calling out the Hardys. And then it becomes a reminiscing session of them talking about all their great matches in WWE. The first TLC match, the first table match, their ladder match at WrestleMania in the Astrodome, you know, all of the WWE great matches that they've had over the years. They're standing in this ring reminiscing. And, you know, I got to say, between this and all of the ECW nostalgia that we've seen over the last several weeks on these shows from the Manhattan Center, or the Manhattan Ballroom, I guess, as they call it, Paul Heyman had a great line. I think it was from the interview he did with Ariel Helwani a few weeks ago, where he said, one of TNA's biggest problems, if not TNA's biggest problem, is that it does a much better job of promoting WWE and ECW than it does TNA. And I just think it's so true. It's so true. But anyway, this was to set up a match in the main event, Hardys versus Dudleys, their first match in like 12 years. You know, in the building, it felt like a big deal. again, I could have done without them going on and on and on about their WWE matches. You know, you could just, if anything, have a quick mention and move on. You don't have to go into the whole thing of where it took place and, you know, boy, those were the good old days. So that got a little old, but they set that main event up for the end of the show. We had Low Ki beating Homicide, DJ Zima, Tigre Uno, Manic, and Crazy Steve to become the number one contender for Samoa Joe's X Division Championship. This got real good in the end when it came down to Low Ki and Homicide. Ki beat him with the Ki Crusher. EC3, Spud, and Rhino. This was the segment I mentioned in the spoilers back in June where Rhino inexplicably came out wearing flip-flops, because nothing says War Machine or Man-Beast like a pair of flip-flops. EC3 wanted Bully Ray terminated for what he did to his Aunt Dixie the week before. Kurt Angle came out, said EC3 would be wrestling tonight or else he'd be out of here. Carter refused, and so Kurt called out the cops, New York's finest, to come take them away. This was funny. You know, Rockstar Spud is great in his role. He started mouthing off. He said he had diplomatic immunity at one point. They took him down pretty violently, too. They took him down to the mat. Rhino, you know, they cuffed him as well. EC3 was going nuts. He started throwing dollar bills at the cops to bribe them and talking about how rich he is and how he knows Donald Trump and all these different people. Bernie Madoff, I guess they're tight. Well, they may be tighter now if they share a jail cell. So he got arrested and all three of them got taken away. Mr. Anderson beat Gunner by DQ. This was a nothing match. The people, look, I was there for this match. This was the first match of what I thought was the second taping. At least that's how we looked at it in the building. This was the one match on that taping, on those tapings, I should say, back in June, that the crowd shitted on and did not care about. And it's not hard to see why. I mean, they taped stuff out of order, so it didn't even make sense why these two guys who were already out earlier in the show would be coming back and now they're wrestling each other, you know, because they don't show us any pre-tapes or anything like that. And even if they did, let's be honest, Mr. Anderson and Gunner, nobody gives a crap. So people were they were doing the yes chant, and they were singing Adam Rose's theme song, and they didn't care. They didn't have a reason to really care. And the match was short enough where it didn't even really matter. Sam Shaw came out, and who cares? We then got an update on Dixie Carter. We were told that she has multiple fractures in her back, and Mike Tenay said that he would have an exclusive sit-down interview with Dixie Carter next week on Impact. Actually, I think he said next Thursday. Which tells you how late in the game that decision came to move Impact to Wednesdays, that they couldn't even do voiceovers. You had Tanae multiple times on this show talking about 1 week from tonight, next Thursday. Yeah, that's great. Although I guess it's not TNA's fault. I assume it was just a last-minute decision that Spike made, and TNA really didn't have much of a say in it. So that was kind of weird. But the bigger issue here is that Mike Tanae is even going to have an interview with Dixie Carter on the show next week, because I was of the impression they certainly had it framed perfectly where the table bump would be the end of the Dixie Carter character for the foreseeable future. Maybe not forever, but for a long, long time, this woman, this near 50-year-old woman, was put through a table. Her back was broken. You would think, great, we are now spared any more nonsense from Dixie and Dixieland and all that bullshit. She's finally off the show, and we can just be rid of her for at least several months. Nope. She's back on the show next week. They're already bringing her back to TV next week. Unfucking believable. Unfucking believable. They couldn't even keep her out longer than a week. She's like the John Cena of TNA. Seriously, that's exactly what she is. She is the John Cena of TNA. They just cannot keep her out for more than a week. People hate her guts. It's just unbelievable. Gail Kim won a four-way match to retain her Knockouts title over Velvet Sky, Angelina Love, and Taryn Terrell. This may have been the four-way, by the way, that I mentioned in the spoilers last week from the tapings that we were at. The most recent set of tapings, I said there was a four-way match that they taped kind of out of order. It wasn't part of the Hardcore Justice show. So it looks like they took that match from the most recent tapings and they kind of shoehorned it in there. Unless they had two four-ways, which I don't think they did. Bobby Lashley, MVP, Kenny King, beat Bobby Roode, Austin Aries, and Eric Young in a six-man tag team match. Pretty good stuff, too, actually. Lashley speared the hell out of Austin Aries to win the match for his team. We had an Abyss interview setting up next week's Stairway to Janus match, which is part of Hardcore Justice. So Hardcore Justice is going to be next week. That was the most recent show we were at. So I guess that means I'll be on the show again these next 2 weeks. Look for a guy in the front row with a giant mohawk. We're sitting right behind him. Same spot as we were in last week, only we're in the second row. But you cannot miss the guy with the giant mohawk. James Storm did a very bizarre promo out in the woods in an outhouse somewhere with Sonata. Sonata is like his slave, I guess. And this right here tells you everything you need to know about how Japanese talent typically is used on American television. And this, look, WWE doesn't treat them any better, but TNA certainly has a very poor history when it comes to Japanese wrestlers that they bring in, okay? Tanahashi, Okada, both of whom were under, I don't know if they were under contract to TNA, but they were certainly working for TNA. They were on Impact and all the shows. You know, look at them now. Who knew? But Sonata here, who is being groomed to be the top star of the Great Muda's Wrestle 1 promotion in Japan, is like, I mean, I don't even know how to describe the guy here. He's a slave who's under the spell of James Storm. He's like all subservient to him now for reasons that still have not been explained. They're out in the woods. James Storm kicks the cameraman out. God knows what he's going to do to the poor guy now. Maybe I don't want to know, quite frankly. Team 3D in the main event comes out in their old school gear. Bully's wearing the old school camo, and Devon's wearing some of his old gear from like 2002, 2003. They beat the Hardys with a 3D on mat. This went over 15 minutes. It was actually a really good match, and the people were into it. It was a nice little bit of nostalgia. Two teams that can still go. Bully and Devon, the funny thing about them is, if you look at them physically now, compared to their prime run, if you want to call it that, back in WWE, so go back 10, 12 years, they're in the best shape of their career now, and they're a hell of a lot older. You know, Matt Hardy maybe has seen better days, but he's still pretty good. Jeff Hardy is still doing his thing. This is a pretty good match. And the Dudleys win in the end, and that's how they went off the air. So that was Impact from this week. Overall, another good show. The fact that Dixie is going to be on the show in any capacity next week infuriates me, because she just should not be on the show anymore. The woman got powerbombed through a table. You told us the extent of her injuries. Why must she be a camera whore and put herself back on the show so soon after? What purpose does that serve? Ring of Honor was back in New York this past Friday night. Brand new venue for them for the first time. MCU Park in Coney Island, which is the home of the Brooklyn Cyclones minor league baseball team. And Ring of Honor taking the old slot that TNA had for, I'd say, about 5 years. TNA, with all the TV they were taping in New York City, I guess they figured they probably weren't going to be able to sell many more tickets if they came back to New York for another show. And so Ring of Honor got the spot instead, their Field of Honor show. Last Monday, according to the person I talked to with the stadium when I checked with them, they had about 900 tickets sold, and they were hoping by showtime to have 1,500. If they didn't get there, they were close. But keep in mind, it is a stadium that fits 7,500 people. When TNA first came to the ballpark for their first show, they had 5,500, which was a very healthy crowd. It was probably their biggest crowd in this country for any show at that time. Every summer thereafter, the crowd dwindled and dwindled and dwindled. They never quite hit that 5,500 mark again. And I guess the big difference is that TNA has national cable television. Ring of Honor does not. I expected them to do a little bit better, but if they did hit 1,500, it's a pretty good number. You know, it's a pretty good number. At the Manhattan Center for a show, they would usually get in the 2,000 to 2,300 range. So this was less. But it is a new venue. It is harder to get to for some people. I mean, it's not hard to get to. It's the last stop on a bunch of different train lines. And you come out from the train, and it's literally two blocks away. But still, you know, it's not as easy as it would be to get to at the Manhattan Center. The Manhattan Center, you get off at Port Authority. You're right there by Madison Square Garden. It's a big transportation hub, and it's literally right there. So they had a decent crowd, but what I said earlier in the show was, I mentioned like a bad crowd. I didn't mean bad crowd in terms of attendance, because they had a decent number of people there. Not great, but I meant crowd behavior. The crowd really embarrassed itself to the point where I was almost ashamed even, you know, to kind of be from Brooklyn at one point. And maybe that's a little extreme, but there was a moment in one of the matches, and we'll get into it when I get to that match. It was the ACH match where things just devolved, and it really marred the show. It didn't ruin the show, but it really left a black mark on it, and I think it was shameful what was going on during that match. So we started out with a steel cage match. It was Jay Lethal against Matt Taven, with the stipulation being that if Taven won the championship, he'd get 5 minutes alone inside the cage with Truth Martini, Jay Lethal's manager. And if Matt Taven did not win the championship, he would never again be able to challenge for the TV title. So they had the cage set up because I think they wanted to quickly take it down. So they figured, let's have that match first and get it out of the way, which was smart. So they did the match. Jay Lethal won, which shocked me. I thought for sure Matt Taven was winning. So Lethal retained the title. And it was so weird because the match ends, okay, Lethal wins. It's the first match of the show, and then they announce, we're now taking an intermission because they had to take the cage down. And so intermission went on for like 15 minutes. I mean, it was, you know, it wasn't short. Finally, the action continued. We had Takaki Watanabe from New Japan Pro Wrestling against Mark Briscoe. I was kind of moving around during this match. I think Briscoe won. I'm pretty sure Briscoe won. Cheeseburger and Brutal Bob Evans against Moose, whose real name is Quinn Ojinaka, and R.D. Evans. Ojinaka played for the Falcons, the Rams, the Colts, the Patriots during his NFL career. He's only 30 years old. Technically, he's still a free agent. He can go back to playing football, but he wanted to try pro wrestling, and ROH signed him, and I think he's been training at the ROH Academy, and he's still very new to this. Big guy. Definitely has the size. Very green. But he was in there teaming up with R.D. Evans, and the two of them won the match. So, big win for them. Mike Bennett beat Rocky Romero. You don't realize how hot Maria Kanellis is until you see her in person. She's very, very attractive if you see her in photos, if you're watching an ROH show, let's say on iPay-per-view, or their TV show if you have ROH TV in your area. You've got to see this woman in the flesh, in person, to truly appreciate her magnificence. She is the one that got away from WWE. I don't know how you let a girl like that go. Not only is she hot, but she was actually over. She was very popular when she was in WWE. I don't remember if it had to do with John Cena or not. There was something that happened, and I think that's why she got let go. But, you know, hey, WWE's loss is both Mike Bennett and ROH's gain. They are actually a very entertaining act together. So Bennett wins. BJ Whitmer, Roderick Strong, Jimmy Jacobs, the Decade, beat three students from the Ring of Honor Academy, substituting for War Machine, not to be confused with the MMA fighter of the same name who beat the shit out of his porn star girlfriend and finally got apprehended by the cops the other night. That menace to society now is off the streets. So one half of War Machine, his name is Roe. He was involved in a motorcycle wreck last week. He's going to be out for a while. They were supposed to challenge the Decade here. Obviously, they could not. So they had three students from the ROH Academy, one of whom, probably the one that was in the best physical shape, had half his face painted white. And I think it was painted white to look like a baseball. But like from where we were sitting, between the white face paint and the pants he was wearing, it was the exact same tights that Seth Rollins wears in WWE, those tight pants, those tight leather pants. So he got a chance of Sting Rollins. We, you know, the people morphed two wrestlers together, and they kept chanting Sting Rollins at this guy. But the Decade wins in the end, and Rose tag team partner Hansen did come out at one point because the heels kept beating the crap when the match was over out of the students. They couldn't defend themselves. So the one uninjured member of the War Machine team came out to chase the heels away. But again, hey, that goes back to what I said earlier, right, about Eddie Edwards and Davey Richards and how when an injury happens or if somebody fucks up in some other way, you know, if you're part of a tag team, what happens to your partner directly influences your career. You know, that's the risk you run when you're part of a tag team. Silas Young and Tommaso Ciampa. Silas Young gets the win. Pretty good match. Cedric Alexander and ACH. This is the match where the crowd, you know, went into business for themselves. And what ended up happening is, among other chants and among other stupid things that were going on, there were some fans who were throwing streamers into the ring during the match. Now, at ROH shows, it's commonplace, as you would see in Japan, to have streamers thrown at you. It's a sign of respect. So you throw streamers at the guy before the match, during ring intros, and people will quickly scurry in the ring, clean up the streamers, and the match, you know, goes on. You don't throw fucking streamers into the match, you know, into the ring during the match. You don't do that. Now you're just throwing debris and trash into the ring, and you're going to get your ass removed and ejected, which is what should have happened. I think they only gave the people warnings. Me, I would have kicked their ass right out of there. So that's number one. Number two, the crowd decided that they would kind of divide. It was like divide and conquer almost, where the crowd that was in front of the baseball net, because they kept the net up. Our seats were behind the net in the actual stands. If you had a VIP ticket, you were in front of the net on the field. What used to be dirt. It's not dirt anymore because Hurricane Sandy destroyed the field. And so now it's, I think, AstroTurf. But so you had the fans on the field, and you had the fans behind the net. And for whatever reason, a war broke out between the two sides. So the people that were sitting in our section behind the net, the so-called cheap seats, which weren't that cheap, started chanting $40, $40, $40 at the crowd in front, you know, as if to say, well, you know, you guys overspent on your tickets, you're stupid, so F you. And the people in the VIP seat started chanting VIP. I posted a little video clip on my Instagram page, a brief clip of what was going on. And, you know, at first it was kind of amusing, but then when it kept going on and on and on, and people were throwing streamers in the ring, meanwhile, you've got ACH, and who's awesome, and Cedric Alexander in the ring busting their ass trying to have a great match, and nobody is paying attention to what those two guys are doing. And, you know, it was just complete disrespect for no reason. You don't throw shit in the ring. The chants didn't even make sense. It wasn't like they were chanting at the guys. It had something to do with, like, the wrestlers. It had nothing to do with the wrestlers at all. The crowd went into business for itself. It was all about them. A couple of morons started to chant, "We are awesome," in the VIP section. You know, seriously, we are awesome. They thought it would be appropriate to start chanting, I guess, because they were sitting 5 feet in front of where we were sitting. So that made them awesome. No, that made them stupid, is what that made them. So this was an embarrassment. It had nothing to do with the wrestlers. It was really a shame. I felt bad for those two guys. And in the end, you know, Cedric Alexander got the win with some sort of driver powerbomb type move. ACH landed right on top of his head. It looked like he legitimately spiked himself or got spiked into the mat and may have been hurt. He ended up walking off. I haven't read or heard anything about him being injured or going for a test or anything like that. So it seems like he's okay, but that was a really scary moment. And that would have made it so much worse for him to like break his neck or suffer a bad injury in that match when people weren't even paying attention. You know, this was embarrassing. And the people who started those chants should be ashamed of themselves. Then we had a tag team title match. Red Dragon, Bobby Fish, Kyle O'Reilly. Perhaps the best tag team in the world right now. Against Christopher Daniels and Frankie Kazarian, the former Bad Influence. I actually thought it was a good match with a very lame, disappointing finish. It was almost more of an angle than anything else. There was interference from the Decade. I guess that starts a program now between the Decade and Daniels and Kazarian, since they cost them the match. So it was a good match, nothing great, lame finish. We got another intermission at this point for fireworks, because every Friday night in Coney Island, they shoot off fireworks at 9:45 p.m. no matter what. You don't want fireworks going off if you're in the middle of a wrestling show trying to have a match. So they paused the show at that point for another intermission while the fireworks went off. And I thought it was kind of funny because as this is going on the field, kind of in the infield, you had Bobby Cruz, the ring announcer, and Steve Corino playing catch. Just throwing a ball back and forth for like 20 minutes until this intermission finally is over. And then it was time for the main event. Four-way match for the ROH World Championship. Michael Elgin, the defending champion, against the IWGP champion, back fresh from New Japan, AJ Styles, who got the biggest reaction of anybody on this show. Jay Briscoe and Adam Cole, the former champion. This was the best match on the entire show. People were definitely into this match, unlike some of the other ones. Great near falls at the end. Elgin wins, retains the title with an Elgin bomb on Cole. Adam Cole is great, by the way. He's very entertaining to watch, and the things he shouts during the match. So Cole is great. Elgin, and that's the only time, by the way, you'll ever hear me use that expression, Cole is great, on this show. So Elgin retains the championship. The first match and the last match were the best matches on the entire show. The ACH, Alexander stuff, through no fault of their own, was an embarrassment and a debacle in many ways. Not the best ROH show I've ever been to. I'm not really even sure that environment works for Ring of Honor as well as an indoor building would. They'll be back indoors for Final Battle, their big final show of the year, coming up on Sunday, December 7th at Terminal 5 in Hell's Kitchen, New York City, Bully Ray's old stomping grounds. It's a nightclub that used to be known as The Mirage, and if that sounds familiar to any of you, The Mirage Nightclub is where the very first Shotgun Saturday Night was taped. And by the way, why aren't those shows on the network? That's another question. Anyway, it was closed. I didn't know this. I had to look this up, but it was closed originally by the DEA in 2003, which should tell you what was going on over there. The Drug Enforcement Administration had to shut them down. Fits about 3,000 people. The new venue does multiple levels with different music being played on each. I've never been there, but to me, it sounds a lot like Webster Hall, which is where I went for my first TNA show. My first ever TNA event I ever went to was, I believe, their first New York City show at Webster Hall 6 years ago. I remember walking in, not knowing where the hell our seats were, and seeing this attractive older lady, she was wearing jeans, just standing there. And, you know, she kind of caught my eye a little bit, and I'm looking and I'm thinking, all right, I'll go ask her where I'm supposed to go. It looks like she may be part of this whole thing here. And she was very nice, really nice, told me exactly where I needed to go. I didn't find out until later that night that the nice older lady that helped me out was Dixie Carter. I liked her better when she stayed off TV and I had no idea who she was. So if this is anything like that, it's a small venue but very intimate with a rowdy crowd, you know, it could make for an interesting night. I'll probably be there. I don't have my ticket yet, but I am planning on going. And with the date being a Sunday, it would make sense for that to be the next Ring of Honor pay-per-view. You know, the first one they did back in June reportedly did about 12,000 buys, which is more than most TNA pay-per-views in recent years have done. I guess that number was good enough. We'll know for sure soon if it's going to be on pay-per-view. That would be my guess, since whenever Ring of Honor comes to New York for a show, it's almost always on a Friday night or a Saturday night. I can't remember there being a Sunday night show. I'm not saying there hasn't been, but the fact that it's on a Sunday night, it's their big Final Battle show, that was the rumor that if they did well enough in June, their second show would be the one in December. All the signs are there. I guess we'll know soon enough. Let's move on to the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email them to me, thesolemonster, @gmail.com. You could also send in MP3 audio questions. You want to email your attachment, try to keep them to about 30 seconds, and always include your name and where you are from. Jake from Trenton, Ontario, Canada, has an update for us on the WWE Network. He says, I remember you talking about the WWE Network going international and how up here in Canada they're doing it as a cable channel. Well, I have some firsthand information about it from the cable companies. First off, where I live, we only have three providers, Rogers, Bell, and Cogeco. Both Bell and Cogeco do not carry the network. With that said, Rogers does not provide TV services in my area and most of eastern southern Ontario, starting outside of Ottawa and ending near Oshawa. What this means is that one of, if not the most densely populated parts of Canada cannot get the network. Well, that sucks. But that update comes to us from Jake, so thank you for that. This week's audio question comes to us from Silvino in Las Vegas.
With the Shield being one of the greatest teams of all time in the WWE, my two questions to you are, one, how would you personally book the reformation of the Shield? And two, when it comes time for Seth Rollins, Dean Ambrose, and Roman Reigns to be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame, do you think Rollins, Ambrose, and Reigns should go in individually, as a team, or both?
Well, I would not get ahead of ourselves here. This guy's already putting the Shield in the Hall of Fame. They have to actually have Hall of Fame careers first. You could say that they've already had a Hall of Fame-worthy career, you know, given some of the people who are in there. These guys have already come in. They've been main eventers almost since day one. Some of them have held belts, not all of them. Actually, no, I think all of them have. Yeah, they all have. Tag titles, U.S. title. And look, I'm sure Roman Reigns is going to go on to become a big star. Seth Rollins has a shot. Dean Ambrose has a shot. I think all three are going to be big stars. I can't tell you who will be bigger. I could say Reigns because the company is behind him right now more so than Rollins and Ambrose. So, you know, he's got the rocket on him. Whether you think he's better than them or they're better than him, it doesn't really matter what you think or what I think. It's what they think. So, yeah, in the end, it wouldn't shock me if all three of them ended up being Hall of Fame worthy. But that's, you know, come on, 15 years down the road. You know, I'm not putting him in the Hall of Fame now. So it's hard for me to really think about it like that. And it's hard to know how their careers are going to turn out. You know, the Shield could end up being a footnote. These guys can go on to have great singles careers to where the Shield years, I mean, really, they were together for 18 months. It wasn't even a full 2 years. So the Shield stuff may be an afterthought when it's all said and done. I hope their careers are so successful that we can actually forget about the Shield years, as great as those were, because that would mean that their singles careers would be even better. And I want to see all three guys succeed. So, you know, by that point, probably should just go in individually, not as a unit. As far as the reformation of the Shield, there were rumors a few weeks ago, actually maybe a couple months ago, that WWE was already planning how to go about doing a Shield reunion. Not necessarily to put them back together full time, but almost on like a special edition of Raw or as a one-time angle. Maybe kind of like what they did with Evolution earlier this year. The Shield reunites. I'm sure they will reunite at some point. You know, right now they hate each other, Rollins and Ambrose, but time heals all wounds. I'm sure we will get a Shield reunion at some point. If you were asking me to book it as like a fantasy booking type scenario, it's not going to happen, but I almost think if the Shield were together right now or were to reform right now, then I would be all for doing something where they reunite for the purposes of standing up to this invading force from NXT, much as they were. They weren't really acknowledged too much as being the NXT guys when they came up, but it was mentioned a couple of times that, you know, hey, it's three guys from our NXT, you know, developmental league, I think, or something like that. They were the three guys from NXT who came in and ran roughshod over everybody in the company. They would triple powerbomb anybody and everybody. They were terrorizing the entire roster. Well, you've got three very talented guys coming to developmental very soon in the form of Kenta, Kevin Steen, and Prince Devitt. All three, by the way, who were brought in with much fanfare. So say what you want to about Kenta. Why are you bringing them up? You know, just an indie lover, right? You'll always have people who love to say stupid shit like that. It just makes me laugh. Hey, WWE must feel the same way. They had Hulk Hogan in the ring with Kenta during his contract signing. And there's the photo online of Kenta with Triple H. There's the photo online of Kenta, of Devitt with Triple H. There's the photo of Steen with Triple H. These have been some of the most high-profile signings that they've had ever. So they must have big plans for these guys, you would hope. What if they all came up at the same time? God knows that they don't have to spend much time at NXT. It's not like Devitt doesn't know how to wrestle. It's not like Kenta doesn't know how to wrestle. So what if they spent very little time at NXT? And within a month or two, you bring them up. You bring them up together. They come out 1 week, kind of like The Shield when they first came along. They attack, whether it's Cena or just random people. You know, they're this little invading force of talented guys from NXT. And you do a Shield reunion where you can get six-man tag matches out of it. You could do The Shield against Kenta, Kevin Steen, and Prince Devitt. Can you imagine the matches that those six guys would have together? How awesome would that be? You'd have to come up with the backstory for, like, a reason for why the Shield would reunite in the first place, let alone to go up against these three. NXT is kind of the common tie there. You know, it has something to do with that. And, you know, the Shield feels like, you know, we used to be those guys. That was us. We were those three guys coming up, running roughshod, thinking our shit doesn't stink. We got to band together and get rid of these three guys. And then you get a bunch of great matches out of it. They have a bunch of six-man tag team wars. Man. That would be awesome. Anyway, Ricardo in Jersey City, New Jersey. Is it valid to say that New Japan Pro Wrestling could perhaps be the best wrestling promotion in the world right now? I have given this question a lot of thought. I truly believe that New Japan has a much better product in terms of in-ring and entertainment value. They have a roster full of talent that can clearly make stars out of anybody, such as Okada, when he won the IWGP title a month after returning from TNA. Yeah, and you know, that's an interesting point. I mentioned that earlier. Tanahashi, Okada, these were guys that, you know, maybe they weren't quite at the skill level they are now, but clearly they had something. New Japan saw something in them, and they became two of the best wrestlers in the entire world. And they were under the guise of TNA for a while, and TNA did nothing with them. And in fact, in the case of Okada, I think, they gave him some stereotypical Japanese bullshit because they don't know what the fuck they're doing over there. And you look at Okada from then, from that period, to where he is now. And Okada, you know, is probably the best wrestler in the world in a lot of ways. You know, he's a draw for New Japan. He's probably their biggest star. I know Tanahashi has been for a number of years. I think that Okada has supplanted Tanahashi. At least it seems that way to me, as the big star that they're building around and the most popular guy now in the company. You know, in some ways, on some level, it's almost like, you know, having Tanahashi and Okada together in that company at the same time, it's kind of like what WWE had with Rock and Austin at the peak of their popularity. And that's kind of what they have now with Tanahashi and Okada. There's a lot of talent there. Okada is a great case of building a star from the ground up. They took a guy who was damaged goods probably from TNA when he came back to Japan. They put the IWGP championship on him, as Richard said, as Ricardo. They put it on him right away. He's won the title, I think, another one or two times since. He's got two G1 wins under his belt. I mean, he's a big deal. He's a much bigger deal than he ever was before. And that's how you build a star. That's how you build a star. You don't put roadblocks and obstacles in his way or book him in stupid angles or stupid comedy promos or any of that shit. You book him like a star. If you book him like a star, people will look at him as a star, and that's what he is. But to go back to Ricardo's question, he says, he's talking also about the foreign talent that New Japan has, AJ Styles, giving those guys the proper recognition that they deserve, that they did not get before. He says, I know that when it comes to the American market, WWE has home field advantage, but I truly believe that New Japan has been on such an amazing roll from their shows and annual tournaments that it may be a true challenge for WWE down the road. Am I wrong to think this? New Japan is not challenging WWE anytime soon. It's just not going to happen. If they ever could make headway in the American market, it's kind of like soccer, right? Everybody goes crazy for the World Cup. Like, all of a sudden, they're big football fans. And then the World Cup ends and everything goes back to the way it was and nobody gives a shit about it. They've tried. God knows they've tried, you know, making soccer big here in this country, and it's just never worked. And I don't know that it ever will. And maybe it's that way with Lucha Libre and Japanese wrestling, and maybe it'll never really truly break into this market beyond the hardcores. So I wouldn't be worried if I'm WWE, because New Japan is in their own country doing their own thing right now. You know, they have their iPay-per-views here in this country, which is maybe 2% of the audience that watches their iPay-per-views. So no, I don't think they're worried. I don't think they have any reason right now to be worried. The only thing I might be worried about, and I know this, they don't lose any sleep over it, but maybe they should, is that there is another company somewhere in the world that is making millions of dollars and doing very well and doing 10 times the job that WWE is in building new stars. If anything, if I were WWE, I would be embarrassed. I would be utterly embarrassed that this company overseas can do a better job than they can. The biggest wrestling company in the world is WWE, and this other company is doing a better job than they do of building new stars. That's the only thing I would say between the two that WWE should be worried about. It's being upstaged by New Japan. Business-wise, no. They don't have anything to worry about right now. And, you know, New Japan, though, is certainly doing very well. You know, there was a period several years ago where there was a real lull for Japanese wrestling. And Japanese wrestling is not anywhere near the heights it was at if you go back to, like, even the 90s, the mid-90s, with a lot of those guys. Misawa and Kobashi and, you know, I mean, even Stan Hansen, when he was in Japan, he may be the most popular foreigner to make a name for himself in Japan. You know, because he went over there. He left WCW. He went to Japan, became a big star, and pretty much just stayed there and was very well respected and would wrestle other Americans, too, when they came over to visit. He had some wars with even guys like Hulk Hogan and Vader, that famous match where Vader had his eyeball knocked out in a match with Stan Hansen, which you could find on YouTube. So Japanese wrestling is not at the peaks that it once was at. It's kind of like WWE now. They still make a lot of money, but they're nowhere near the peak of popularity that they had in the late 90s. But New Japan, you know, I looked it up, and The Observer is great in terms of having this business information, so all credit to Dave Meltzer for this, but they nearly doubled their revenue over the last 2 years. New Japan is expected to pull in about $23 million this year, which is up from 11, so they're on an upswing. And again, a lot of that has to do with their stars getting over. Okada, Tanahashi, Nakamura, who I also think is very entertaining. And actually on Okada, I want to mention this too, because I saw a note on this, and I actually thought it was really cool. Okada recently opened something called the Rainmaker Foundation, which is a children's cancer charity. And apparently he himself will donate $300 American every time he wins a match using the Rainmaker, which is his clothesline, his lariat clothesline finish. And I guess that's retroactive to the start of the year. So all the times through 2014 so far that he's used the Rainmaker successfully, he'll donate $300 to this charity. I think that's very cool. And the guy's only 26 years old. And you look at everything he's accomplished in just the last few years. The titles, the multiple G1 victories, some of the best matches of all time. Certainly of this era. That this guy's been a part of. The problem with a lot of those New Japan guys with the style they wrestle, you know, Okada may be only 26, but it's probably more like 36 right now. And when he's 36, he's going to be moving around like he's 46. That's the problem. That's probably the biggest problem with the style they wrestle. But it's entertaining as all hell. If you actually watch some of those New Japan matches, it's great. Jesse from Texas, as a person who has been enthralled by Japanese wrestling, I had a lot of Japanese questions. I haven't even included them all in the mailbag this week, but there's definitely been an upswing since the G1 started and ended in questions about Japanese wrestling. So he says, as a person who's been enthralled by Japanese wrestling lately and has not watched WWE or TNA in over a year and have only been keeping up through your podcast, can you explain to me why TNA wants me to tune in to see a middle-aged woman get put through a table, or why WWE wants me to tune in to see a middle-aged woman in a match on pay-per-view? Well, are you not sports entertained by that, Jesse? Is that what you're saying? I can't imagine why. Mill from Philadelphia. Why does WWE always say that guys are too small to wrestle when it's a work anyway? Why is somebody like a Bryan Danielson or a CM Punk considered too small to beat somebody like a John Cena or a Randy Orton? Yet, week after week, Cena is beating people that in real life he doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell of beating, like Big Show, Brock Lesnar, Mark Henry. What are your thoughts on 200-pound wrestlers who are 5'8", being considered too small to beat dudes who are 6'1", 240, yet those 240-pound wrestlers are not too small to beat wrestlers who are 400 or 500 pounds, who stand nearly 7 feet tall? It makes no sense to me. Thank you, Mill. That is a great question, a rhetorical one, I hope, because I don't have a logical answer for it. You are absolutely dead on. It does not make sense. It is a double standard. You're right. You're right. John Cena's a big dude. I've met John Cena before. He is big. You meet him in person, he's a freak of nature. But you stand John Cena next to the great Khali, and if it's all about size, right, and all about appearance, Khali should be able to just take his fist and pound him into the ground. Mark Henry, the world's strongest man, right? Maybe not anymore, but that's what they call him. But he's a legit big guy. He's not a guy you want to meet in a dark alley. 400 pounds, he'll pound you into the ground too. You put Mark Henry in there with a Randy Orton, okay, and all the injuries he's had, he's like glass, this guy. He's broken his collarbone twice, and you know, you touch him the wrong way, and he has a little hissy fit. You put Randy Orton in a room with an angry Mark Henry, and yeah, it's going to be bad times for Randy Orton. Big Show. Big Show can take out anybody on the roster that he wants. He's the Big Show. He is a giant. He could kill you. So the whole notion of guys being too small in wrestling, unless you are a midget wrestler, okay, Hornswoggle, now you've gone too far. I can't buy Hornswoggle in the ring with a John Cena or a Daniel Bryan or a Randy Orton. Okay, we're not talking about that, though. What we're talking about are guys, like you said, who are probably average. They're not even really that small. 5'8", 5'9", I consider that to be average. By WWE standards, yes, it's small. But if those guys more than make up for it in the ring or in their appearance or their personality or their promo skills, but they're just a few inches smaller than you'd like for them to be, but they can go, and they're popular, or they're over, it shouldn't make a damn bit of difference whatsoever. And it is a double standard. Drew from Chicago, in a day where WWE is trying to sell the network, do you think at a minimum they should at least put one match featuring NXT stars on Raw and SmackDown every week in that dreaded dead spot before the main event? I think this will get people who watch Raw and SmackDown to see what they are missing on the network while keeping me from doing other business while waiting for the main event to begin. What do you think? I think that's a bad idea. I mean, you said it yourself. You called it the death spot. Why would you take two guys from NXT who, let's assume nobody knows who they are in that building. Very few people watch the network, follow NXT. It happens to be a crowd of mostly casual fans and hardcores who just don't follow along. So they don't know who, you know, Adrian Neville is. They don't know who Sami Zayn is. And you're going to take those two guys and put them out there in the death spot on the show, after people have had to sit through 2 hours and 45 minutes of shit. You're going to put those two guys out there, they don't stand a chance in hell. You are already handicapping them in their very first appearance, and you've got a man standing in the back, or sitting in the back, at the gorilla position, who we know has no patience. And if there's one match, and it bombs, that could be it for those two guys. You only have one chance to make a really good first impression. Vince McMahon has no patience at all. Bo Dallas, supposedly given up on already. Do you really want those NXT guys to have the same fate? I think they would be better served to air a video package highlighting the best of NXT from that week. Do personality profiles on some of the guys, some of the key stars, with a message at the end that says you could see these guys and more. The future of the company is now, right now, on the WWE Network. I would rather they do something like that than just put a match out there cold with no build-up and no story in the death spot of all the spots on that show. I mean, if you were going to give them any spot, you would have to give them a top-of-the-hour match or the very first match on the show, like the Cruiserweights back in the WCW Nitro era, who would start the show, they'd give them 15 minutes, and they'd tear the house down and really get people excited for all the action that night. Those are the only spots that would work. I just think there's so much wrong with putting them in the death spot that you're doing more harm than good if you do it that way. Frankie from Rockledge, Pennsylvania. Looking at the WWE roster, I can't help but notice there are only four legit tag teams. The Usos, the Wyatts, Stardust and Goldust, and Rybacksel. They also have the Ascension in NXT, although some fans have not been impressed with them. There simply are not enough tag teams to have a solid division. With that being said, should WWE be concerned with the lack of depth in the tag team division? Also, which tag teams from the Indies or TNA, if they should go out of business, should WWE go after? I don't think WWE is concerned about it at all. Maybe Triple H is. Maybe there are people under Vince who are concerned and would like to beef up the tag division. I don't think the tag division is really that much of a priority to them. Because if it was, it wouldn't be as weak as it is right now. And they probably wouldn't have broken up the Shield as quickly as they did. As far as teams that you know, they could poach from TNA if they went under, or from other indie promotions. You know, and by the way, you left out Mark Henry and Big Show, and you know how I feel about these makeshift tag teams. Maybe it'll work. You know, I did see the end of their match on SmackDown. They did that whole deal where I guess Show gives the knockout punch while they're in Mark Henry's grip, and then he follows through with the World's Strongest Slam. That's their finishing combo. So that's a new team, it looks like, for now, Big Show and Mark Henry. As far as teams they could bring in, the Wolves, they passed on the Wolves. They had their chance. They didn't want them. But I still think they would be a solid addition to the tag division there. The Briscoes, there was some interest there. Jay Briscoe went and made a stupid homophobic remark on Twitter, and that pretty much spelled the end of them. Yet another example of being part of a tag team. If you're Mark Briscoe and your brother went and shot his mouth off and fucked up your chances to go to WWE. But the Briscoes, I think, would be an asset to them if they can, you know, behave themselves and watch their mouths. And, you know, if you've ever heard of Briscoe's promo before, they're very entertaining, but that kind of promo won't fly in WWE. So if they could adapt, I think they would be a good addition. Kaz and Enzo from NXT. You talked about bringing up the Ascension. Not everybody is a fan of them. I'm not their biggest fan either. Colin Cassidy and Enzo Amore together as a combo, as a unit, I think, could be brought up tomorrow and could get over and be very popular and be a great asset to the tag team division on the main roster. So those are some teams right there that come to mind. Victor from Sweden. What would you think about a Lesnar-Orton program? I've always found it weird they never worked a big-time match. I know they wrestled on SmackDown in 2002, but now when both are big stars, a match between them would be very interesting. Would you want to see a Brock Lesnar-Randy Orton match? Right now, no. I have no interest in a Brock Lesnar-Randy Orton match. Now, if Randy Orton turned babyface again or went tweener and started getting big-time reactions and was having all these kick-ass matches and he was over and he actually, you know, meant something. Right now, Orton doesn't really mean much. He's been phased down. I find most of his matches of late dull. It really depends on his opponent. I think the person who he's in the ring with, how exciting his matches can be. In the right circumstances, I wouldn't mind it. I just feel like right now, Brock Lesnar and Randy Orton, there's no real interest. There's no real money in that match. And right now, no, I don't have any interest in seeing it. Sean from East Chicago, Indiana. That's an interesting place. Kind of like West New York, New Jersey, which is a real place, by the way. Just doesn't sound right. Anyway, he says, I'm sort of getting caught up in the hype from Devitt, Steen, and Kenta, even though I haven't seen any of them wrestle. Which one should I be the most excited for and why? You should be excited for all of them. They're all great wrestlers. Devitt, to me, is the one who stands out as being the most impressive when you watch his matches. And there's a lot of, you know, aerial stuff and flips and stuff. But he's a great wrestler. He's very, very exciting to watch. Now, maybe he'll come to NXT and they'll tell him to tone it down like they do with everybody else. They did that with Neville. It was a match with him and Neville, though, back when Neville was Pac on the indies that got Triple H and WWE's attention. And that's what got Neville hired. And I think that's probably what ended up getting Devitt hired, too, was that one match that they saw between them that they thought was amazing. And so they brought him in. But Devitt, to me, is the most... maybe extraordinary is a word for it when you watch their actual matches. Steen is great, but in a different way. Steen's not out there doing flips and dives and shit. I mean, he'll do a dive every now and then, but he's more of a brawler who's kind of a badass like Austin was back in the day and is very good on promos. He may be the strongest, actually. In fact, I'm sure he is the strongest of all three on promos, so that's his strength. In-ring stuff is more Devitt's strength, and Kenta is more of a smash-mouth kind of I'll-kick-your-head-off, very stiff kind of personality, also a very good wrestler. So they each bring something different to the table. It depends what you're interested in. If you're not interested in all the flashy moves and the flips and stuff, you may not like Devitt so much. If you want more of a brawling, in-your-face, smash-mouth kind of guy, you might be more interested in Steen or Kenta. I think all three are fantastic, and that's why they got signed. And just go on YouTube and type any of their names in, watch any of their matches, and I think you'll be impressed. Octavius from Grove City, Pennsylvania. There are too many times where wrestlers kick out at the most devastating spot in a match, only to be pinned later by the opponent's finisher in a weaker-looking spot. Anytime I see someone kick out of Luke Harper's sit-out powerbomb or Michinoku driver, only to be pinned later by his weaker-looking discus clothesline, it doesn't make sense to me because the match ends on a weaker note. Doesn't climax at the right point. So my question is, how much of a negative impact do weak finishing maneuvers have on the excitement or overall quality of a match? Well, first of all, why you would ask me, of all people, a question about not climaxing at the right point, I'm not quite sure what you're trying to imply there. But you do have a valid point. We have seen a lot of matches like that on the indies. I saw a lot of matches like that even at the Ring of Honor show, where it looks like that's the climax, that's where the match should end. This guy has taken so much abuse, he just cannot take any more. And somehow he manages to kick out, and kick out, and kick out. And then he gets beat on a weaker-looking move, and then finally he gets pinned. And I guess you could rationalize that by saying the guy just ran out of gas. You know, he kept getting up as much as he could, and yeah, it was a weaker-looking move, but it was after all of that other stuff, and of course he got pinned. He just couldn't take it anymore. You know, he was out. He was out of gas at that point. you know, pro wrestling is it's all about showmanship, and you want to end on a high note. And so we've seen that plenty of times in all of the major companies, WWE included, where you see something spectacular, and you're like, that's got to be it. That's got to be the finish. And then they do the near fall kick out. And then whatever the actual finish is, it sucks by comparison. And it's like, damn, they would have just, if they would have just cut that last 3 or 4 minutes out of the match, it would have been perfect. I'm with you. You know, it happens far too often. Brenda from Harlem, New York writes in, I'm a longtime wrestling fan and have been watching since the late 70s. My favorite show for years was, of course, Crockett's every Saturday at 6:05 on TBS. And I ask you again, why is WWE not airing WCW Saturday Night on the network every Saturday at 6:05? It just seems to me like that would make sense. She says, the show made me a big fan of old-school NWA-style wrestling. My question is this. When WCW went over and TNA took its place, why wouldn't TNA try and play up that it was the successor to the legacy of the NWA in the South and try to attract those old-school fans like myself? That's not the approach they wanted to take. It was more important to them to bring in a guy like Vince Russo or Ed Ferrara and all the people they brought in, throwing shit at the wall to see what sticks in the early days. And if you look at some of those early NWA TNA shows, they were god-awful. I mean, there's no other way to put it. They were WWE light in every sense of the word. It was no different than what you would have seen on TV on the other channel, except WWE was actually pumping out a better product at that point. The people running or booking TNA in those early days, you know, whoever they were booking those segments, and you can kind of figure that out for yourself, were stuck in a time warp from a few years earlier, and they thought that that's what people wanted to see. And guess what? If that's what people wanted to see, then TNA would have built up this massive audience. It's not what people wanted to see. That's why they went through so many writers and regime changes, because they couldn't find a formula that worked. And when those old NWA WCW fans saw what WWE was doing and they didn't like it, they went away. I'm not really sure they could have gotten those people back anyway. I think once those people were gone, a lot of them were probably just gone for good. They just gave up. But yeah, you probably could have tried to get back some of them, and you could have put forth a more serious product like Crockett had back in the day. It's just not what they wanted to do. Now, they're still alive, somehow. 12 years later, TNA is still around. They're barely hanging on now. But they've managed to stay afloat, but they've never really been all that successful. Had they taken the direction that you just mentioned, which in a lot of ways is like what Ring of Honor has been over the years, right? And Ring of Honor has been around actually 3 months longer than TNA has been, also about 12 years. And Ring of Honor is also only successful to a point. So it's hard to say how much more successful they would have been had they taken that approach. They may have been more of what Ring of Honor would become. But even Ring of Honor is not so successful that they have, you know, a major cable deal like TNA does. At the end of the day, TNA is on Spike and ROH is not. So I don't really have a good answer for you. And lastly here, Justin from Puerto Rico, longtime fan of the podcast, he writes in, he wanted me to let you guys know that he is running a giveaway on his YouTube gaming channel. The name is Uprising Gaming. So if you type in Uprising Gaming, two separate words, you'll find his channel, and you can subscribe to it. He is giving away a copy of WWE 2K15 for your console of choice. His channel recently hit 3,000 subs, and now he is looking to give back to those who have helped him. I assume I am disqualified from the contest, Justin? No, I'm just kidding. I don't even own a gaming console, so it really wouldn't do me any good, but I know a lot of you do. It's very easy to enter the contest. Just subscribe to Justin's channel. Again, the name of it is Uprising Gaming. He has a video up there right now explaining the rules of the contest. Be sure to like or share that video and leave a comment on that same video. And if you do that, you are officially entered into the contest. The deadline is September 5th, and the winner will be announced on September 12th. Uprising Gaming is the name of his channel, so be sure to go ahead, and if you want a copy of WWE 2K15? Who knows? If it's your lucky day, you may be able to get yourself a copy for free. This week's sad tweet, we actually have two of them. First one came from Marty Jannetty, at Real Jannetty on Twitter, who during Raw last Monday night posted the following. He said, if the NWO does not show up tonight, I'm taking Robin Williams' path. That's nice. That came from Marty Jannetty, who perhaps was drunk or drugged, or maybe not. Maybe he was completely sober and just being stupid. But that was a pretty dumb thing to say. So that came from Marty Jannetty. The other sad tweet came from at the Academy, which is the official Twitter account for the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, on Monday night. This was after the death of Robin Williams was reported. They posted, "Genie, you're free," with a photo of Genie from the movie Aladdin, which was a character that was voiced by the late Robin Williams, who is believed to have committed suicide last week. I don't know if it was Sunday or Monday, but he took his life at the age of 63, I believe he was. And now we found out since then, not only was he suffering from depression, which was known, but he may have also been, well, according to his wife, he was in the early stages of Parkinson's disease. And I don't know if he left a note. I don't know if they're aware of something we're not, if that had anything directly to do with the suicide. Maybe it was just a combination of a lot of different things he was going through in his life. Either way, it doesn't matter. It's a very sad situation. He was a great actor and a great comedian, very funny guy. I have been a fan of his since I saw him in the movie. What was the first movie I saw him in? I don't remember what the first movie was that I saw him in, but I did see the movie Mrs. Doubtfire, which was not his best movie. But I thought, you know, him having to go back and forth and play those two characters in that movie was very entertaining. Of course, he was in the movie Hook. He was also in a movie that doesn't really get talked about a lot. He was known for his comedy. He was known for being a funny guy. But he did have a few serious roles. And I know, you know, the movie Good Will Hunting and all that. But he was in a movie that Christopher Nolan directed called Insomnia. And it was a movie that also had Al Pacino in it. It was a thriller. And it was a serious role for him. This was not a comedy role. This was not a lighthearted movie. And I liked that movie a lot. And I thought Robin Williams was really creepy and just really good in that movie. See, he played a lot of different roles in his career, more comedy than not, but just a really funny guy. And it's always sad, you know, there's a sad twist to this when it happens to somebody who has spent so many years bringing laughter into other people's lives and making people laugh. He made a career out of making people laugh, really, for the most part. And for his life to come to an end under such sad circumstances, and to think that he was going through whatever it was that he was going through and felt the need to take his life, which is never the answer, by the way. Because I know there's people who listen to this podcast who have suffered from or are right now suffering from depression. Some more severe than others. And I could tell you right now, I don't care what you're going through, taking your own life is never the answer. It just shouldn't even be considered, but it is. Because that's how serious a problem it is. But people just need to understand that there's always a better way. Because once you do that, there's no turning back. It's nice to have options in life. And you take all of those options off the table when you make a decision like that. And it's too bad that he made that decision. And his life had to come to an end the way that it did. So rest in peace, Robin Williams. And to Marty Jannetty, my advice to you, grow up. If you have questions for the mailbag, you could email them to me, thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. Please remember to include your name and where you are from when you write in. You can listen to this podcast each and every week on thesolemnmonster.com. You can also subscribe to this show on Stitcher or in iTunes. And let me just say something here about Stitcher, because we had a problem with Stitcher last week. It took like over 24 hours to get this show up on Stitcher. Just be aware, and I've said this before, I have no control over it. When the show doesn't go up in a timely way on Stitcher, I push the show through in one location. And from there, it pushes out to everything else, to iTunes, to Stitcher, TuneIn, Player.fm, the Android app, everything. Everything is through one upload that I do through Podbean. And after that, it's out of my hands. Why it would go up on iTunes, it was up on TuneIn Radio. I think there was a little bit of a delay there, but it was up there. It still wasn't up on Stitcher. It was up everywhere except Stitcher, and that's on Stitcher. Ask them. I email them. They don't answer me back half the time. Maybe the best course of action from now on is let me know so I'm aware of it, but tweet them. Tweet Stitcher. Go on their website. Find their feedback email address. You'd be helping the show out, actually, if that happens, by emailing them, giving them the name of the show, give them the URL link for our Stitcher page, and let them know the latest episode is not up. What's up? Why isn't Sound Off not up? I want my Sound Off. We'll start a new campaign, like I want my MTV back in the 80s. I want my Sound Off. Hopefully we won't have that issue again this week with Stitcher, but I just wanted to mention it because if it happens, just be aware that I am aware of it. It's out of my control. It infuriates me. I'm with you. But it's really a problem on their end, and all we can do is just make them aware of it and hope that the show pops up as quickly as possible. And, you know, I'm upset about it, too, because whenever that happens, it wreaks havoc with our rankings. You know, we were routinely in the top 10, and then when that happened last week, it knocked us down into the top 20. So it has a negative effect on this show as well when that happens. But that's also why I try to make sure the show is available through a lot of different means. There's always direct download, you know, right-click save as or stream from thesolemonster.com. You can get it in iTunes. You can go to TuneIn Radio now. We're on there. The Android app. We have an unofficial app for Windows mobile users in the Windows Store or Marketplace, whatever it's called, for Windows 8.1 users. So a lot of different ways to get this podcast. You are never truly without the Sound Off, but I know some people do prefer Stitcher over the other methods. Just be aware, it's frustrating, but not a whole lot that can be done. But do subscribe to us on there. Hopefully everything is sorted out now, and you can leave a review for us on there as well. I also want to give a thank you to TV Trax. TV Trax has been a big supporter of the show now for a number of years. He gets clips of the shows up on his YouTube channel. We've picked up a lot of new listeners who have been exposed to our podcast through TV Trax, so my thanks to him for that. And that's about it for this week. You can make a PayPal donation on thesolemonster.com. Sign up for an Audible trial as well, audibletrial.com/solemonster. You can get a free 30-day trial of the Audible service. You get one free audio book. We had a really great July. I'm hoping that we can end August on a high note, but we can only do that with your support. If you sign up or get a friend or a family member to sign up, it doesn't cost you anything unless you want to stick with the service and go beyond your 30 days. Otherwise, you get a free audiobook out of it, and it supports the podcast. So why not sign up? Audibletrial.com/Solemonster. Pass that URL around. Let people know that they can sign up, and I would very much appreciate that. We'll be back next weekend for a brand new episode, episode 342. We'll have thoughts on SummerSlam and hopefully the new WWE champion, Brock Lesnar, among other things. And until then, be well, stay safe. We will see you right back here next weekend. Until then, enjoy SummerSlam. Take care, guys.
You've been listening to the Solemonster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Charlotte into the cover on Natalya! Charlotte's the NXT Women's Champion!
The bad.
We officially strip Daniel Bryan of the WWE World Heavyweight Championship.
It's a good night to be right.
And the ugly.
I made the mistake of reading Vince Russo's blog. He talks about how it's not creative. No, it's the crowds that are dead, and it's all theme park visitors who come inside because it's too hot outside. 900 people did not wander into the fucking impact zone because grandma was about to keel over from heat stroke.
Well, mostly the good.
Some monster sounds off.
Since 2007. On thesolemonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
Solo Monsters Sound Off.